Here's the way they look at it. Here's their metaphor for the end of innocence. Adam and Eve were held prisoner in the Garden of Eden by an unjust, cruel, and vindictive God. Until Lucifer, through his agent Satan, set man free from this garden by giving him the gift of intellect. Through the use of intellect, man will conquer the earth, will conquer nature, and will himself become God. It's taught in every Masonic temple in this land, every secret brotherhood, every secret society, every mystical temple, every occult organization teaches the Luciferian philosophy. They do not believe in Lucifer. They do not believe in any entity called a devil, and they do not believe in God. It is a mistake for you to assume that they do. They are atheists in the strictest sense of the word. They are humanists. That's their religion. At the highest level, their goal is to create a world in which the adepts, the thousand points of light, working behind the veil to create the culmination of the great plan, can realize the ultimate happiness for mankind.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 16th of May 2025, streaming live from a corner of freedom close by Bristol city centre. Don't believe a word we say, as we do our best to share a few flashes of clarity from the Bristol Temple of Port, at least it was, maybe it still is, turned merchant venturer fortress in Tampon Charlie's empire of lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from APK Pure or Apple App Store, but not the evil Google Play. And by the way, there's a new bunch of links to the app to make it easier to download this week. It does need updating if you want to get all the show links, so you can just click away. Oh, it actually works really well. Nick has done a super job, because by the time we get to Sunday, any of the stories are clickable. So anything you've heard on the show, you can click and check for yourself, because, like I say, don't believe us. As well as tonight, usually by about midnight, you get all the longer clips, the longer interviews we're going to be hearing clips from. They're also there on the app, and you can download them, or you can just listen live to them. So you can look at them, two or three, whichever you like, and just download them to your phone and listen in the car at your leisure. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its zero-trust agenda psychological warfare, bending our minds with sophisticated distortions, or boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators, and hatchet jobs on the heroes, turning the truth on its head quite a lot of the time. McCarthyite witch hunts going after everyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against the rentiers, World War III, or wage slavery. With those with eyes to see and ears to hear the so-called solutions to the multiplying crises, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate, the twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse. And the politicians have nothing to say, because all the political parties' apparatchiks make sure that there's nobody with anything to say becomes a politician pretty much nowadays. Well, there are a few, one or two. Nick Land's techno-behaviourist dark enlightenment cowards and control freaks want us as slaves to their AI, or maybe just dead. Albert Pike's World War III curse relies on blind obedience. Meanwhile, the wife-murdering pantheist Wef King and his vampire queen Carmilla wage war on China, Russia and the BRICS, as well as the Iranians, of course, and the British people. The Crown prosecutes us for praying, and the only right they seem interested in is our so-called right to kill ourselves these days, with the help, just like during the jabs, of your friendly GP. But it's not the end of the world, or is it? As we learn, you learn. So helping us navigate the WEF's Fourth Reich is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. I'm also joined by local council candidate for the Workers' Party, Steve Gower. Well, as promised, we'll be looking at the IRA and Steak Knife this week, as well as, just by pure coincidence, the BBC's Panorama this week was looking at the SAS. So that's quite handy. We'll look at both of those together. We'll also be looking at the Rich List. I spoke to Kevin Carhill earlier today, former Rich List journalist, about what the Rich List is not telling you about the super rich. And I'll give you one guess. The name Tampon Charlie, it should be at the top of the list, says Kevin, but he's not. He's although he's done quite well this year. And we'll be looking at the all of the crisis in the Middle East particularly as well. So I suppose we'll start by introducing you, Steve. You're from the Workers' Party. Can you just tell us a bit about Galloway's Workers' Party? What's the aim? Why are you there?
I've been following George for around about 7 or 8 years. And in recent times, I was in the Labour Party during this 2017 election, 2019. And I got the customary anti-Semitism stamp on my head, like many others did.
So what did you say or do to get that?
Basically, Twitter. It was just messages on Twitter that weren't my messages, but I was just reposting them. And I got summoned. No, I didn't. It was COVID, so I couldn't even speak for myself other than in writing. It was most unjust. And
So what were you saying? What was it that triggered
I'm trying
this?
To think what it was now. I think one of them was what Corbyn posted when there was a load of... The one I can remember... Because they wouldn't even show me the pictures when they said I was being accused of anti-Semitism.
Were you suspended or what?
Yeah, I was suspended for 12 months. They didn't teach me anything new. They didn't bring me into the office and say I was a naughty boy. I just come back in after COVID with my Palestine flag and said, I wanted to rejoin at the time. And I looked around and I thought, no, there's no point. I could sense it that I wasn't made feeling welcome, not by the members, but by the hierarchy. So I left that party, become a bit disillusioned. That must have been 21, 22.
But what about electoral politics generally?
As in?
Well, voting.
Oh, Labour.
Elections.
Yeah, Labour all my life.
Any other party?
No.
And did you lose friends from the Labour Party because of all that?
Not the ones that were friends, no. Some have stayed. In fact, I spoke to one this morning. She's great. And I think the light's starting to open. I think she's seen the light.
So yeah. What's happened to the Labour Party?
I can't speak for them other than I got my suspicions, obviously, when I was suspended. I didn't know what anti-Semitism is. I certainly do know what it is now, thanks to colleagues around Bristol, in fact, and further afield. And I found out that I'm not anti-Semite. At the end of it, and I'm very glad for the people that have taught me exactly what I believe.
Well, the Labour Party's obviously decided it doesn't need you, Steve.
Oh, definitely. I don't need them. That's more important. I don't need them.
So what have you been doing with the Workers' Party then?
I was a candidate in the general election last year, and I was in the council elections this year. Made new friends and colleagues, didn't get actually voted in, obviously, but I think the tide's turning, especially with the fact that I'm also associated with a local Palestine solidarity group in Gloucester that gets the word out as well that we're anti-war, but we just don't pick and choose our wars in the Workers' Party. We say no to all wars, so it's no to NATO as well.
So if another Hitler started rolling across Europe, you would just wave a peace flag?
No, I'd negotiate. That's what we do.
I'm not sure you can negotiate with. I mean, the Palestinians, they're trying to negotiate with Netanyahu. You can't always negotiate it when someone is a war machine steamrolling towards you.
I think then, with what's happening in Palestine, with regards to negotiations, there haven't been no serious negotiations. we could have negotiated it from day one and said you weren't having any bits from the F-35 jet, because obviously them bits are made in UK, so we would have a bit of influence to say, look, your war is going to stop. But we didn't, and that's called negotiations, that's called, de-escalating, which is what I've been into as well with the local campaign with Insulate Britain.
So Insulating Britain, what's that for? Stopping the energy use. Isn't it better just to cut the price of energy and cut the fuel bills?
No. The thing is, they've got a switch, and they switch your electric off. So it doesn't matter where you source it from. If it's coming into a lead or a pipe into your house, they can switch it off. So what's the point in having it? They could always got that over your head and you're never in control.
What are you saying? No gas, no electricity? That's the future?
Oh, no gas, yeah, because obviously that comes in a pipe. But that's the only reason, personally, I wouldn't have gas.
Do you have gas? No? You have electricity?
I have electricity, yeah.
I mean, this sounds a bit like you want us to go back to the Stone Age.
No, you have electricity. It's great stuff. It's, you know, you run your TV and...
If you can afford it.
Oh, you would, because it'd be free.
What?
Yeah.
What's that, nuclear power?
No, it's solar.
Well, why is solar power free?
Because you put it on your roof, the sun shines, and you get electric.
Right, well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because that's not what's happening.
It's
up in fields, not on people's roofs anymore.
Exactly, and that's stupid. All them fields, we could grow plants and God knows what, a vegetation. Absolutely crazy.
So is this part of the Workers' Party policy or yours?
This is mine. I've got to talk the Workers' Party into it.
Anyway, you've been campaigning, I know, on homelessness, haven't you? Why are you picked on homelessness?
I was homeless myself in 2016. I had a relationship breakdown. I left my partner's house, walked to the council offices and expected a council flat within a few weeks. And 7 months later, I was still in the house of multiple occupancy with individuals that I wouldn't normally talk to, let alone live with.
So what was that like then? But you were renting somewhere, were you?
No, it was basically a big house with 19, 20 rooms in it. Old Victorian place, and they chucked us all the rabble in there and said, get on with it.
So is that the council that put you in there?
Unofficially, yes. They signpost me to it, but they wouldn't recommend it. I understand why, because they closed it down about 12 months after because people were dying in it.
Well, that sounds like a horrific story. Tell us about that place.
It was the best experience I've ever had. I know it sounds like that way, but if she hadn't have took me in on that day, I would have had nowhere to go and I'd have been on the street. I didn't come out of my room. It was like a prison cell, or police cell, I know now. And I was 49 years old, and like I said, I was sharing a toilet, a bathroom, kitchen with individuals I wouldn't even say hello to in the street. But after 3 months, I think it was, you start bumping into people and talking to them, and then thankfully, for the grace of God, that would have been me, my lifestyle from your dot, but it wasn't. It was from the age of 49, and I've been advocating for them ever since.
So this is a private individual with a large house, is it? What was going on there?
The individual who was running the house has had a heart of gold, and she's still running HMOs now, or HMO elsewhere now. The owner was the problem, where she wouldn't do all the things, you know, like putting new windows in and stuff like that, and bedding and stuff. So financially, she was hard up.
Surely, I mean, you can sort some bedding out, can't you?
Yeah, where I was, there was bedding already there, but the first night I was there, I wasn't sure if anyone had died in it the night before. Change the bedding afterwards.
Well, what about, were there washing facilities, cooking facilities?
Yes, washing and cooking facilities. Obviously, I only just had a bag in my hand with some belongings, so there wasn't a lot of washing was the issue. But there was a bathroom as well, like you could share with men and women. They walked into you if you hadn't locked the door, and I walked into them if they hadn't locked the door.
But, I mean, that's normal in a shared house, isn't it?
Yeah, if you know the individuals you're staying with, yeah.
And it's better than, like you say, better than sleeping in a shop doorway or under a hedge.
Yeah, absolutely, but it still isn't right for the 2018 or 2016 I was living there.
And so you were there for how long?
7 months.
And why did you leave eventually?
A charity that I hadn't heard of before come in and said that they'd pay the first month's rent on my private rental flat. And they give me the month's rent, bless them, and I've been in there ever since.
Okay, and so your situation is a bit more stable now? You've got a bit more privacy?
I've certainly got a bit more privacy. It's this house is actually older than the one I come from, which was the HMO. This one's about 200 years old, and it's got them windows.
Sash windows,
that's the word, yeah. And the landlord has just sold up, so he's selling up, and I've been told that by September I should get an eviction notice.
Right, well, at least that's a few months to look. I mean, we have a housing crisis, Martin, don't we, in this country? What Steve's describing is kind of normal nowadays, whereas you used to be able to get digs, as we call it, pretty easily back in the 1960s and even into the 70s, as you used to be able to actually pick and choose a job if you wanted to. Nowadays, it's a whole new ball game.
Well, it is. Obviously, in Bristol, we've got the second highest rents in the country after London. So you've got a big housing crisis here. I mean, I'm in a one-bedroom bed sit, for which I pay £650 a month. And, you know, it's just not up to scratch. You know, I mean, the landlords, I've been there 10 years, but when I got that flat, I was kicked out of my other flat because what will happen if there is another financial crisis is all the buy-to-let landlords will sell, and everybody who's in those flats, like me, will be out. And of course, you won't get somewhere else. It's only because I had contacts in the Labour Party in Easton that I was able to get into where I am. Because I went, because they were saying we're not taking anybody on benefits. I was on benefits at the time. So I came back in the second time and said I wasn't on benefits, and I got to the actual meeting with the guys who ran the agency, and I knew them because one of them had been a Labour council candidate, and I said, well, actually, I am on benefits, and they said, all right, for you, we'll fix it. And so what I had to do was I had to get my dad to come down and show his finances, because this is what they do with students, and therefore they got me in there. But if there is another financial crisis, the landlord where I am will sell up, and then it will be very difficult for me to get anywhere else. And, of course, this is a real problem. We can see it. If you walk around the streets now today, as I was walking here, loads and loads of people are definitely sleeping on the streets in Bristol because they come from outside as well, because there's more of an infrastructure.
OK, well,
support.
We know there's a problem. How do we fix it?
Well, we should have been building council houses.
No. Not what we should we have done, because we're starting at the point now, yeah? How are we going to sort this, turn it around?
Well,
I'm going to ask Steve first, because I know you've thought quite a lot about all this. We've got a housing bubble, which is a very, very high price of housing, extremely high, and it's almost as if that's deliberate. It's being prodded in lots of different ways to keep up and, you know, to keep the economy, I suppose they call it growth. But anyway, any thoughts about how to fix the housing crisis, the housing problem?
Yeah, I was going to ask a question. How many empty properties have you got in Bristol?
There's plenty of empty... I was just going to say, Tony asked me what to do. Yeah. There's plenty of empty properties. We're going to have to start requisitioning those properties, aren't we? Yeah.
Isn't the easiest thing to do is just tax them so that the person that realises that they cannot leave them empty? I mean, we're also talking about commercial, loads of commercial property empty. Right. For example, some of the tower blocks, you'll find the first couple of floors have got tenants, but the top 20 or top 10 floors have no one in there.
Well, you could have a situation where nobody's allowed to have a second home until everybody's got a first home. I mean, in places like New Zealand, people can't come in and buy up property. Unless, there's all sorts of rules and regulations about it. And, of course, they're talking about, you know, the housing crisis in this. There's plenty of spare housing. We don't even need to build any more. There's loads of it. It's just being, you know, there's a block down here, but a luxury tower block that's been built next to City Park, Castle Park. And, of course, it's an eyesore. And, of course, what it's got in is loads of wealthy people who never even, you know, hardly anybody's registered to vote in there. Same with all these big tower blocks in the centre of London. They're actually owned by Colombian drug lords, Saudi princes, and what have you. And, of course, they're there to be put people in.
Anyway, Steve,
yeah,
fixing the problem.
Absolutely. I'm into that, into fixing it. Well, you start with the empty properties and you repossess them. You just take them off the actual owners. Apparently, that's what Starmer was saying in 2019. I heard something coming out recently. All right, so we got the power to do it. The council at the moment, I think, are just putting 20% or 30% on top of council tax for an empty property. Put it up to 100 or 1,000%. Doesn't matter. Let them go bankrupt. They'll soon bring out the landowners then, or the house owners then, and then tell them you want to fill it up. And if you want to rent it out, this is another part. With the housing, quality of the housing in this country, let alone in Bristol or Gloucester, up the rating, up the EPC rating and the quality of the housing. That'll shut everyone down, as in close all the all the rogue landlords, you repossess them houses, obviously, because they won't have a license to actually rent properties. That's good. We got more properties than in the stock then, and we use that collateral then to buy the other properties. Once we've got the other properties, what are we going to do with them? If they're fit for purpose, do them up, refurbish them. If not, then knock them down. Because the housing stock in this country is the worst, not only in this, the housing stock in Bristol and Gloucester is not the only worst in England, but England is the worst housing stock in Britain, in Europe. So there's no qualms about knocking them down. And they may look pretty, then fair enough, take the brickwork down, put your new unit in or house in, and then put the brickwork on the outside. It's more jobs, jobs for everyone. And in fact, the housing trade, it could create millions of jobs, or thousands, hundreds of thousands of jobs, which would keep our boys off the street and keep our boys out of fighting wars that we shouldn't stick our noses in. So the answer's there. We've got to use what we got at the moment, but build quality housing. Quality housing. 21st century housing, and not 18th, 19th century housing that we got today.
Well, a lot of the modern housing seems to me very small rooms, but and no gardens. A lot of these new housing estates. Anyway, the situation in Bristol is we've got something like between 650 and 700 people living up on the Downs. That is in caravans. And this is the Bristol Downs, and in mobile homes. Motorhomes. And so the BBC Breakfast last week covered that whole story. Let's have a listen to them now.
You shouldn't be on the Downs then.
What's the night? What's it got to do with you?
On the leafy streets of Bristol, tempers are fraying.
Attitude.
No, it's called standing up for rights.
Residents want these caravans moved. Some who live by the roadside are feeling victimised.
The stuff they're posting is just absolutely ludicrous. In fact, it's bordering on hate crime.
Danny's been here on and off for years.
It's not like we just sprung up overnight, and there is no answer to it until you answer the housing problem. You'll see it in lots of other towns. You know, youngsters, what, can't afford rent, can't afford nothing, so they're going to take the option of where they can live.
We're agreed it's the council's inaction, that's the problem. Yeah.
Residents want something done and have started a new group called Protect the Downs.
Some of the van dwellers, I'm not saying all, empty their cess into the drains, into people's gardens and into the bushes.
So I have a great deal of sympathy for people that are homeless. I really do. But there are lots of people up here who are not.
People are storing firewood and they wonder why these caravans go up in flames. You know,
they complain about abandoned caravans blocking the road and being used for drug dealing or worse.
This used to be renowned throughout, well, not just Bristol, the South West, or used to be famous across the country. I'd heard of the Bristol Downs when I was living in East Anglia. So I know it was once a treasure place and now it's become a sink.
Well, it's like a sink estate, isn't it? Interestingly, one of the comments by the lady there, I think it was saying about drug dealing. Maybe it was a fella. I'm afraid the drug dealing also goes on in some of the houses around. It's not just the caravans. I find it a little bit irritating when they say things like this. And what are they doing with their human waste? Where's that going? Well, you know, there has to be somewhere for it to go. You can't expect it to just disappear into thin air. Steve, what do you think of the little battle going on up there? Local residents started to get organised, saying we've had enough of all these vehicles up here.
I have sympathy with them, obviously. I don't know the particular instances about the Downs, whether they've been there for months, years or
well,
weeks.
Years, yeah. I mean, I think if you go back, Parry's Lane had about probably something like 20 vehicles on it, like 5 years ago. Okay. Slowly but surely, it's got more and more. And there are various sites around the city, probably about five or six major sites. And now they're talking about nearly 700 people living in vehicles like that.
I'm personally working on a project called the Blue Lantern Pilot Project, which is basically trying to prove that an individual, in this case it would be myself, can live off-grid for 12 months on solar, using rainwater harvesting and with a sewage system built in. There are things you can do with sewage, as there is obviously with rainfall and obviously with energy regarding solar. I don't know much about the Downs issue, but if the people of the community can find a place where they're happy, where these individuals could stay, with the fact that they would be producing energy and too much energy probably for their needs, and they can transport that energy or transfer that energy to the local school or local hospital, and perhaps it'll build bridges between the communities, two communities, and it might give empower the travellers there that they are worthy of this so-called lifestyle that we actually live in.
I think what's happened is as the housing bubble gain is what the British economy runs on, and it has done for decades.
You know, I remember hearing years ago, and I don't know if you can confirm this, that actually the house prices are actually the fundamental foundation of the economy. So everybody starts getting very, very... If house prices start to go down, it's a sign that the whole of the rest of the economy can.
That's right. Well, the British economy in particular is exposed to this because of the obsession with home ownership, which goes back to the 1920s.
Well, it's not an obsession, is it? Well, it's not an obsession at all. Martin, you say it's an obsession. Actually, people want to have their own home. It's perfectly reasonable and normal that people would want to have a home so that they don't get evicted.
All
Steve's situation. You're shaking your head, Steve.
No, I don't want to buy my own.
From an economics point of view, what we do in this country is people get tax relief for buying houses. What that leads to is in Germany you don't get tax relief for buying houses, and quite a large number of people, even quite wealthy people, rent. And of course it means that we've got labour market flexibility. You get a new job in another part of Germany, you can just go.
Well, they can get rid of you from your
home.
Well,
yes, but the point is...
This is just a very Marxist and a very narrow-minded point of view.
Well, you could say Marxism is narrow-minded, Tony, but I'm talking about the
economy. There's something wrong with people that want to own their own home. There
no,
isn't.
I didn't say there's anything wrong with them. I'm just saying...
There is. Go on, Steve, go on.
The point I'm trying to make, Tony, is it distorts the British economy. We've been deindustrialised because everybody's building conservatories.
If the house prices were stable, it wouldn't, would it?
Yeah, that's right. If the house prices were stable, people could get onto the housing ladder and buy a house, and people who've got more money would invest it in businesses. Mm. Not in housing.
Well, that's right. That's the situation after the Second World War. Until the 1970s, pretty much.
Well, no,
it was easy to buy a house.
In the 1970s, it was easy to buy a house because at least a quarter of the population, up to half the population, lived in council houses, which then lowered the price of other houses. So if you wanted to skip from being a council tenant to buying a house, it was feasible.
These are one of the reasons why they don't build council houses anymore.
Well, that's right,
because it creates a stable housing market.
No, and not actually, stable, going up. Which means that people who vote Tory can get more money from doing nothing.
You completely misunderstood there. What I'm saying is if you're building council houses, you get a stable housing market.
Yes.
Well, what I'm saying to you is the fact that I'm like nearly 60 now. When I was born, I was guaranteed a council flat, definitely, all right, by the time I was 16 or when I went to leave home. I left home at 25 and had a mortgage that lasted for 25 years. So I'm in debt for 25 years. My son has got the prospect of 45 years of his life in debt. What for? He'll never own that place. Never. There's so many things that go wrong in life, as we all know, you know, whatever. Why would you want to be this time on earth in debt all your life? Until no, I say no, you had your chance, capitalism. I'm afraid it's gone, all right? And there's going to have to be another solution. And if there is another solution, I want to make sure that house is fit to live in. Because these things that they're building now, and they have done in my lifetime, are not fit for purpose. Things have moved on. Am I living in a house that's like we are here? I could buy one, say, that's 50, 60, 70 years on. Or am I? And for another instance, if we talk about electronics... Well, 50 or 60 years on, we wouldn't be speaking here today. So why would I want something like a valve, talking about electronics, working from valves and a valve radio, compared to what we got here now, digital and IT and all that stuff?
So I don't get it at all, what you're saying there, because there's nothing wrong with an older house, surely.
Yeah, it's terrible.
They're much bigger rooms than the modern houses, for a start. Gardens.
Why do you want a bigger room for? There's only one of you, isn't there?
Well, not necessarily, no. You've got a family in there.
Well, then you get a 3 or 4-bedroom house, if that's the size you're talking about. And there's scales for it.
So should they demolish these old houses?
Me, personally, if you can't run energy off them that's like a solar panel system...
Well, they've got a roof, haven't they? You can stick a solar panel on there.
Yeah, but they won't... It's like you choosing... If we had a race here, right? If I had a 2-litre bottle of water, right, that had to be a 2-litre empty bucket... Okay, and me and you had a race. I had a 1-litre bottle and you had a sieve. How much energy would it take for me to do it compared to you? It would take a lot more hard work to power that, to fill that bottle up. You're living in a sieve. So, yeah, you can get energy, like you keep saying.
Oh, what you're saying is the old houses leak energy.
Oh, no, they leak air, hot air. What, the hot air goes through the house, through
well,
the
that's
building.
Energy, isn't it? Yeah.
If you look
yeah.
In, so what I'm saying... So, in Norway, they've got much tighter energy regulations than we've got.
Yeah.
So they build wooden houses, which are virtually... You know, they don't leak any energy at all.
I mean, surely the main problem is not what the house looks like, it's how much it costs and the fact that it's so impossible to afford it. That's the big thing that's changed, it seems to me. And one of the other major changes, of course, is council tax. Council tax is another imposition on people. And I don't know if you're what your sort of situation you're in, Steve, but... before council tax, the rates were something that was paid by the owner of the home, not by the person renting it.
That's when I moved house. That's when the poll tax come in, and we was on it doing shouting and bawling about that. Bless them, because they knew more about it, the adults, than I did when I had my place. But I was paying for that. Was my issue was I was paying for non items that weren't there. It was a brand new housing estate, so you had no lamps, no dustbin collection, and God knows what. Unfortunately, where I am now in Gloucester, they do subsidise the council tax in my district, so I've never had to come onto that.
Well, they shouldn't be doing it, Martin, in the first place, should they? They've got a system to making sure that people with no money get a relief from council tax. Well, why are they even putting the council tax on them in the first place?
Council tax is poll tax mark two. So although it's based on supposedly on you know, the more you earn... You know, the wealthier you are, you've got to pay more, the bigger your house is. But, of course, the rating system was based, as you say, on property, Tony. And therefore, for example, if you were renting from somebody, you wouldn't pay any rates. You'd pay it as part of your rent. It would be part of an implied part of your rent. And, of course, the one part of the United Kingdom where they still do have the rating system is Northern Ireland. They introduced the poll tax, first of all, in Scotland... I'm 65, so I remember I was in my 20s. Yeah. And, of course, they
were always trying to turn the clock back here, aren't we?
Then they thought if we can ram it through in Scotland, we can ram it through in England. They tried to ram it through in England, and, of course, it led to the downfall of Thatcher. Eventually, her own side decided to get rid of her. But they didn't dare to introduce it in Northern Ireland. People go around... Because the enforcement for council tax involved private sector bailiffs going around to take people's stuff away haven't paid.
We'll be talking about that, because Acorn have had a protest.
Ireland, that's not going to work.
Acorn.
Private sector bailiffs coming down the falls or the Shankill Road are just going to end up dead in a ditch, and therefore they couldn't introduce it.
So
of course, in Northern Ireland,
there's
more money spent per head than else in the rest of Britain anyway.
In this
because
week,
of all the trouble they've had.
In this week, there is a protest by Acorn, actually outside the city council here in Bristol. Some guy dressed as a knight in shining armour, challenging the council, and for some reason the council shut the doors on them to stop using bailiffs to take. But anyway, I'd also like to hear from. The UK column, I'm getting into a bit of a habit of playing the UK column, even though I find the whole channel a little bit peculiar. They have some very good stuff on as well. And let's have a listen to their report this week, because we reported on it a few weeks ago. There was a whole meeting down in Exeter a couple of weeks ago, all about council tax and whether it's enforceable or not. Because as Kevin Cahill, I spoke to also today, is saying that these debts are not enforceable. In fact, they shouldn't be enforceable, and that by law they're not enforceable. So let's see what our Sandy Adams reports back from this meeting organised by the UK column down in Exeter all about council tax. Should we pay or not?
Over the last week or two, we've been advertising what was described on the screenshot as a dissident meetup for the South West. Tell us about it.
It was a really good event. It was the tax rebellion. It was about looking at ways that we can resist financing this takeover, this corporate takeover that we appear to be financing through our council tax. And it's interesting because there were many, many different views on how to go about this. And what my takeaway was that we have to somehow bring it all together and find the best way, because there's different people. There's the Sovereign Project, there's the Anna von Rice lot, the I think it's the Community Assemblies of the British Isles. And then we had Chris Coverdale, who's amazing, and David Leitty, who seemed to have got a kind of a thing together to address the non-payment of council tax, or at least withholding it, keeping it in escrow perhaps, but challenging it, saying, look, we don't know where our money is going. At the moment, only 30% of our council tax actually goes to the services that we receive. The rest of it goes into central government, and we don't know what they do with it. Well, we do know what they do with it, but we're not given the choice of where we spend our money. And we're financing illegal wars. We're financing all sorts of stuff that we should not be financing and we don't want to finance.
So that's Sandy Adams. A bit of a vague report there. I would have preferred to have a little bit more detail, but at least there are people getting together discussing this. And also they're conflating a couple of issues there, really, which is, number one is should you pay council tax or not? And secondly, can you get away with saying I'm not paying my council tax because the money's going to war? And I'm not so sure that they're correct in saying that local authority council tax goes back to central government, Martin.
No, in actual fact, local, a lot of what's money spent in Bristol or Gloucester is from central government. The council tax just is a top-up, really. And the other thing about it, of course, is... what was I going to say? It's a top-up, and, of course, the other thing is it's based on an individual paying it instead of a property. So it's very difficult to collect, yeah? You're chasing people for trivial amounts of money. It's often more difficult to get it off them.
We spoke to Catherine Armitage a few weeks ago. She was saying that there's plenty of people now who have come up with sent legal letters in and saying, I'm not paying my council tax, and they get bailiffs coming round to the house to knock on the door, but it's very difficult to enforce the payment of it. We'll be hearing a bit more from Kevin Carhill about that as well. So this is just another imposition. If you're in poverty, Steve, something else you've got to pay. And, I mean, for example, if you lived in Birmingham, you'd be pretty annoyed about being told to pay council tax to empty bins, which have been there sitting for 2 months now, festering and growing every day.
Yeah, of course I would, but then I'd ask him, why aren't these boys picking these bins up for me? That's the issue.
Well, the issue is because they've been told they've got to take big cuts in pay.
Well, I don't blame them then. Yeah. I don't blame them. Well, that's a worker's right, yeah?
Most of the money from Birmingham City Council that's lost was lost on some massive IT contract. They're blaming all sorts of things.
Oracle, get it off them, then.
An IT
Oracle.
Hey,
can I just say something?
Of course.
And it's not just here, but everywhere else, everyone's moaning about this, that and the other. And I'm just thinking, hang on a sec. It's got to be a change of government, or a change of system, I should say. And I'm thinking, I mean, municipal, does that make sense, a social... it's got to change because the people have had enough. And you can talk about poll tax, you can talk about rents, you can talk about housing, you can talk about poor quality housing. But why can't we take it all on our own? And I know that I'm talking a revolution here, but I don't want a violent revolution. But I want a party that will say, right, enough is enough, and then this is it. You know, we'll just look after our own, because you guys have had 30, 40, 50 years of this, all right, basically. And we haven't. We're still as poor as whatever we was before, and yet people have died, our grandparents have died in the Second World War for the rights that we haven't got today.
So Bristol City Council's leader Tony Dyer from the Greens, he was approached 6 months or so ago by Acorn, the community union they call themselves. They stick up for people who are being evicted, if wherever possible, have kind of whole bunches of people turn up at the house to stop the bailiffs. And they managed to find Tony Dyer at the Radical History Festival here recently because he was giving a speech. He's done a book about Anglo-Saxon democracy. Anyway, so Tony Dyer is approached here because he hasn't written back to them after 5 or 6 months. He hasn't contacted Acorn, so they thought they would go and take the microphone and the camera and stick it in his face and ask him why it is that he's still insisting on using bailiffs to collect council tax for people that don't have any money.
Over 5 months ago, Acorn submitted your demands for a Bristol City Council to stop using bailiffs to collect council tax debt. On the final day of our deadline to respond, the council emailed us with no concrete commitments for action. So we decided to visit Tony Dyer, the head of the council, before he gave a talk about the importance of Bristol's radical history, to challenge him on this response, to both give notice of Acorn's action and to become part of Bristol's great radical history.
I'm about to do a talk for these people.
That's okay, just like a 2-minute chat about our demands.
I think we've had this conversation before, but I'm not just turning up when we're doing other things.
You haven't actually delivered on any solid commitments about our demands ending using great companies for council debt collection. We know from our members, hundreds of people have been visited by bailiffs since our original demands were sent to you. We have lots of Acorn members who have been bullied, harassed, intimidated by bank companies, which Bristol City Council has contracts with. We want a much more firm commitment from Bristol City Council to reduce its use of bailiffs, to end its use of bailiffs, to collect council debt from people. Do you not think it's sort of the responsibility of you as leader of the council to deliver on those demands to protect the citizens of Bristol against these corporate firms?
We will do what?
Who are stopping people getting
Okay, thank you. I've now listened to what you have said. I'll go away and think about it. I think you're absolutely right. We do need to take stronger action in terms of how we're able to look after people who are facing, particularly when they're in situations where they have been put into serious debt. Once we discuss and sort out the way you approach councillors and the way we can move forward and work together, I'm more than happy to sit down and talk with you. But let me just finish. That needs to be done on a basis of mutual respect. We will respect you when you demonstrate your respect to us.
5 months without a response, I don't think we're
I've seen the way you've behaved in the past, Sam. I think you really need to think about whether this is the sort of approach you want to be able to have. I've listened to what you had to say. I'm now going on to do this talk.
5 months.
Unfortunately, the head of the council agreeing that more needs to be done isn't enough for thousands of vulnerable Bristol residents who need them to take action now. Bristol Council, you've been served notice.
Yes, you certainly have. And that was a few weeks ago. What do you make of that sort of action, Steve?
I'm sympathetic to it very much, so I'm so glad that I got actually don't have to pay it, because obviously they subsidise us up in Gloucester. But it's good to see people standing up and being counted. All I'll say is, not on this matter, but on other matters regarding housing, is that I've advocated for people to go into properties and then been fit for purpose, and the support system isn't there, and people are getting paid a lot of money. For claiming to do something that they can't.
Well, I think that's true. With people like St Mungo's here in Bristol, we constantly hear that, because I'm part of Bristol Housing Action Movement, which is a squatting support group, because I'm an ex-squatter myself, and there's lots of empty buildings. I mean, it seems to be, we were talking about this earlier, the obvious thing to do, Martin, empty buildings.
There are things you could do immediately to immediately alleviate the problem.
That's it, exactly. Get a roof over your head for tonight.
I agree with Steve. You've also got this is a fundamental thing to grasp in terms of improving quality of life and also making the economy work better. Yeah.
So the council,
housing bubbles that we have in this country, which then go bust, have been the bane of the country for decades.
It's a very, very simple
Every
problem.
Every time we start to go
problem.
Anywhere, the housing
simple,
prices rise.
Very
and
simple
we have to crash
economic
the whole economy.
Problem that makes it very different to places like China is that our infrastructure in this country, all the basic needs, are costing us 10 times more than they should be costing us, whether it's water, electricity, housing. That's where all the costs are nowadays. And he asked, didn't he, the Tony Dyer, can you please reply? We sent you a letter 6 months ago. And he said, I don't think you should be behaving like this, or you're being rude. And, you know, hang on a minute. Look, it's actually you that's being rude. You're the leader of the council. You're in charge of this £600-700 million budget of tax that you get to spend on Bristol. And you think it's rude that someone comes to approach you in public to answer why you haven't talked about the topic to them at all. Anyway, they haven't just stopped. Sorry, go on, Steve.
Yeah, it's a slightly different topic, but going to somebody I call them, but they are people in responsibility, yeah? People with titles, people getting paid for it. On two occasions, one was in Bristol, the mayor here, I come down in 2018 and asked a question, public question in council, when we having our men and women, when we having our mothers and children back to Gloucester, And the mayor said, what do you want about? And I said, well, you've got at least one mother here with four young girls in accommodation that ain't fit for purpose, and it's on your watch, and it's in your city. And he was genuinely shocked. And he come back to me a couple of weeks later, and he said, Steve, there's nothing I can do about it. That was the mayor of this city. And let me go back to Stroud.
So they're moving, what you're saying, just to be clear, they're moving homeless people from Gloucester and accommodating them in Bristol.
Yeah, and she had to take the girls, who are obviously school age, from Bristol to Gloucester schools.
Well, you should think yourself lucky they weren't put in Cardiff or Newport.
Or Middlesbrough.
I'm just ashamed of my city, and I'm ashamed that I was ashamed that this mayor here, but not only him, everywhere else, he couldn't do anything about it. I was in Stroud, and there was a man that died in Stroud, and the MP said, there's nothing we can do. I had a person, sorry, before I finish, there was a young mother with a young child, and she had needles and God knows what outside her flat, private rental flat, damp, mould. She was scared to come out the house now and again because the men were, or guys that were taking the stuff were obviously saying hello and all that. And I said to the MP, he was an MP, and he says, Steve, there's nothing I can do. They're laughing. The landlord is laughing at you, at him. And that's at MP level. This has got to stop. And the trouble is, it's been allowed to come from the top down. So what you're seeing here with these councillors is all they've been taught and got away with for the last 20, 30, 40 years.
Well, there's been a bit of action this week here in Bristol. After all of that, and that report you just heard, doorstepping Tony Dyer, I wonder, you know, how is it that someone with the surname Dyer gets to take over a city? I just don't. I mean, I think someone's having a laugh with us, aren't they? Even though it's spelt with a Y, actually, his Y. But anyway, the point is that Acorn turned up on Tuesday evening this week outside the city hall here to demand. The idea is we've given up asking for replies and talking, and they sent a chap who was dressed as a knight in shining armour with a big sword up to the city council gates, doors, and here's the report they put together about what they did.
Behold a decree from Sir Acorn of Bristol in Norman England, where the fiendish villain of the bailiff was invented. They recovered debts through a method called distress. Yet still today our noble Bristol residents are subject to distress by virtue of these blackguards. History, much like the bins, never gets taken out at time. Bailiffs come to the door of the weary man whose purse is emptier than a friar's ale jug. They come for the widow who hath paid all she could save for a single missed parking permit. They come to the mother who chose bread over a council tax bill, and they take both in return. And what will they take? Whatever be not nailed down and some possessions that are. This is not governance. This is not order. This, my friends, is extortation writ in Times New Roman. We have demanded concrete commitments from the council on abolishing this medieval practice. But all they have to say is, more needs to be done. Ha! Proud Bristol masses, today we must demand more than just sentiments. Today, I, Sir Acorn, march forth to bring action. Bristol City Council, the people throw their gauntlet at you. We will not be silent nor complacent. We are organized and steadfast. Commit to a timeline for abolition. Stand up for your communities and rise to Sir Acorn's challenge. Hurrah!
So let's hope that Tony Dyer arises to Sir Acorn's challenge. When he started talking about timelines, I thought maybe that isn't quite medieval speak, Steve, but they're obviously going for it. They're not going to take no for an answer or say, well, I would like you to go through the proper channels. You're not allowed to come and talk to me here.
I've heard all that. Yeah, not just on this issue, but on all issues regarding poverty and homelessness and what have you. Oh, we've got to do better. We've got to try this. There's not enough money. God knows what. You heard it all before. It's the time now for change, and I'm so glad that people are waking up, regardless of, especially with the cost of living, and what all that entails. And it's good to see. I was, like I said, I was going back to when I was on Insulate Britain. There was 120 of us that blocked the M25. You know, it took 120 of us to stop, to get attention from Boris Johnson.
Were you arrested for that?
A number of times,
prosecuted?
Yeah.
Stopping the M25?
Yeah, and it's a human right.
Why did you do that?
Because I was living in poverty.
Well, look, hang on, because stopping the M25 is not a good idea, is it? All these people in their cars, that they are not, they're the victims as much as you are.
They are the victims, but they just don't realise it. They do now, because obviously time's caught up with them.
I bet they get very annoyed by having someone lying down in the road or standing in the road.
They were at the point, but then I was at the escalator, which meant that I was the first point of contact, and I'm still beautiful and good-looking as I was then.
So did you have any trouble with the drivers? I bet you did, didn't you?
You had a couple, yeah, but they were most understanding. I thought I was going to have my head cleaned off a couple of times, but no, once you started talking and telling them exactly why you're there, for their grandmother and for their granddaughter.
Personally, I just think it's much more of a productive tactic to go to things like annual general meetings of the energy companies, as we saw all the Palestine people at Barclays last week, absolutely shutting down, at least for about 20 minutes, the Barclays annual general meeting.
This is
focusing on the people who are actually profiting and benefiting.
Yeah, I was just representing the people that had died over the last 30 or 40 years, you know, 40,000 a year in the 1970s. You remember them good old days?
Died from what?
From the cold in their own homes. Yeah, excess winter deaths. You probably
heard it. So how is blocking the M25 going to translate into doing something about that?
Because actually what we were going back to was the fact that people needed to insulate their homes, and they're still dying today. This, not just from the cold, but from the heat.
So you're stopping people on the M25 and telling them they've got to put insulation on their homes?
No, I said that exactly. The government should be paying for it to save your life. Yeah, that's just it. You know, like I said earlier on, our grandparents and parents fought, or great-grandparents fought in the Second World War for the liberties that we have today, and they've just been strewn away, and housing was one of them. In fact, it was number three or four, I think.
Martin, what do you make of Acorn Action? It's quite good fun, wasn't it, actually? It's good fun to be part of. They're very good at that, actually.
Well, they're very well organised. I mean, Acorn originally started in the US. It's a franchise. But, of course, the local branch have been very active over many years and over these kind of issues. I worked for Bristol Dead Advice Centre quite a long time ago, 2009. If you remember, Tony, and I was doing research on bailiff, what's happening with bailiffs. And in actual fact, I got some stats for all the different local authorities in Britain about how many bailiffs visits there were. Mm. And of course, there are more bailiff visits in the poorest boroughs, like Tower Hamlets had more than Clifton would have here. But in actual fact, once you'd allowed for that and allowed for there were some places which had much more bailiff visits than others. And I gave it to the because I was cooperating with the council tax department in the council. And I was saying, well, look, what we can do, because if you can't pay your council tax, that's a clear evidence that you're in debt distress. And that what we should be doing is when people don't pay, instead of chasing them to try and make them pay, they should be identified for debt advice and support. Anyway, my great idea led to me being sacked, if you remember.
Yeah, I do, yeah. And it's a survival of the fittest, really, isn't it? Money's all that matters. If you're not productive, then you may as well just stroll off and die, should we say.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's happened over the years is it's like a frog being boiled. The local authorities now, even if they've got good leadership, just haven't got the resources. They're being bankrupted by things like special educational needs provision, for which they haven't got a budget.
Well,
but they've got to find the money for it.
A lot of this goes A lot of this goes back to 2008, as
yes,
you've said on this programme many times. And I was very pleased this week to speak to a marvellous French journalist. I've never come across him before, but I started reading some of his stuff, Pierre Jovanovic, and he's... he was not arrested himself, but he had the French riot police, the SWAT team, raid his house last weekend, and also went round to his publisher and raided the publisher, and then they realised that his book wasn't there that they wanted. It was actually at the printers, and his book is actually called 2008, The Biggest Heist in History. So let's have a listen to Pierre, what he had to say about the 2008 and having, yes, I mean, the thing that they most dislike about his book is he's got a whole list of the people who benefited, and he gives plenty of evidence in the book that they knew exactly what they were doing, that the whole thing was a massive fraud, a hold-up.
The credit default swap was a new tool which basically helped the banks to sell every mortgage to a pool of other people who, when somebody didn't pay back his mortgage, then those people started to pay for them. And initially, it was reserved. This tool was reserved for big banks, like the Banque Mondiale and all this stuff. But progressively, you know, all the banks started to use it, and this is why the between 1997-98 until 2008 exactly, they almost all sold their gold reserve, and they were saying themselves that the CDS is a guarantee, it's the absolute guarantee to see your money back. Unfortunately, this is what we have seen when Bear Stearns fall, when Lehman Brothers fall, when Northridge Bank fall, when the Iceland banks fall. All these people were just taken hostage by Wall Street. So this is one of the second point. There is a third one, but it will take a little more time to explain it. Basically, the point is that the American bankers sold, this pool of mortgages to English banks, to German banks, to French banks, Italian banks, all over the world. Even in Australia, and basically, if Mr. Smith in Arkansas didn't pay back his mortgage, that was the retire system of teachers in Germany who will pay for it. Mm-hmm. And this is what happened. This is what started to happen in 2000, and then 2006, in 2007, and the whole thing blew up in 2008. And the Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and all these banks sold these mortgages with guarantees all over the world.
Okay, so have we recovered from that?
No, absolutely not. Of course we didn't recover. If you take, for instance, the value of Société Générale or Deutsche Bank, if you compare the price of the share, you take the price from 2007 and you look at the price today, there's a perfect example, English Bank, Barclays Bank, for instance. Barclays Bank, it's still, this bank is dead. it's still dead. You know why? Because bankers cannot fool their own traders. That's the point. If you take if you look at the share of Deutsche Bank, which is one of the biggest systemic, too big to fail bank in Europe, there is still this nuclear accident going. Same thing for Italian banks. Take for instance the Monte Paschi Bank.
Yeah, but even if these banks do go down, you know, we've got the reserve banks, haven't we? We've got the European Central Bank, we've got the Bank of England.
Oh yeah, of course. You know, what the Bank of England did, what the European Bank did, and what the Japanese and, of course, the American Bank, they all printed money. And they printed money so much that now you have now since this is since 6-7 years, we have inflation which is just killing normal people. Mm. more money they print and more inflation you have. This is where this is what happened a long time ago in Germany in Weimar. It was interesting to see that now in United States, in New York, if you want to buy, for instance, the 12 eggs, it will cost you like $12 or $14 today. I have a picture on my press review. It's absolutely amazing. So more print, more money they print, and they started to print again last week, especially in United States. You are going to have even more inflation, and the Americans, this is where they are very strong, basically, is that they export their own inflation. So British people are paying for them. We in France and Italians and Spanish, etc., we are paying for them. And this is still going on. What happened in 2007, 2008, it's still going on, and they want to hide it. You want the proof? Last week, the Spanish government decided that if you want to withdraw 3,000 euros from your bank account, you need to write a letter to the IRS, to the Spanish IRS. And if you do not write this letter, you will be fined for 150,000 euros. So this is to impeach people to withdraw their money from the banks. Well, this is where we are today.
Yeah, well, that's obviously to do with they are expecting a run on the bank, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And have in mind something very interesting, because it's a very interesting phenomena, especially in mostly in England, as far as I have seen, but also in France. For instance, BNP, the first French bank, is closing 500 agencies. In England, I think all your banks, they have closed like 3,000 or 4,000 agencies.
Well, yeah, the high street branches are all closing. Yeah,
they're all closing. But why? Because they are telling people you need to use our banking application on your phone. Okay, but look what happened at Silicon Valley Bank 3 years ago. When people heard that Silicon Valley Bank have had some problems, they just hit on their phone and they moved their money in just 10 seconds. And in just 1 hour, Silicon Valley Bank was bleeding. Literally, they were out of business, and they were saved by the Fed. Mm-hmm. So this is the problem. They will impeach people to withdraw money. And I have read in the British press that now people, if they want to withdraw some money, like £1,000 or £2,000, they need to justify themselves. Why do you want this money? Blah blah. Exactly like in France or in Spain.
As Pierre Jovanovic, absolutely fascinating, I think, his take on all of this, and I'd love to see his book. It's not in English, it's only in French, apparently, but I don't know if the French police managed to get it at the printers and grab it. He was saying, apparently, even in Nazi-occupied France, there would be some visits, but they wouldn't raid the publishers, be visits to writers and things. But anyway, Steve, this is just the background to all of this. It's a complete... I mean, the economy here in the West is just on its knees. I mean, I don't think it's just Liz Truss and the banks pointing at her and saying, oh, we don't think you're very good at it. Even the people who are in charge now don't seem to be very good. It's like they're just putting their finger in the dike. Actually, what's happened is they've failed. The economy is failing. And one of the symptoms of that is housing and homelessness.
Absolutely. I think that's... Yeah, that's opened my eyes a bit as well and reminded me of other things as well. Well, basically, at the end of the day, because unfortunately I've got to leave in a minute, but to round it off, for me personally, I want to see a world. And what world do I want to see? Or what should I say? A country. I should say country first, yeah. Or a town. Where no one's living in poverty, yeah? Where you get up in the morning and you feel safe in your own home, okay? You've got a care worker, or a carer, if you're that way inclined. Or you've got a parent that can stay at home and look after you. Happened in my days, hasn't got to go to work. You're not fearful of any letter coming through the door, energy wise or what have you, or utility bill. So you're living and you're free, and your home is warm in the winter and cool in the summer, and you've got excess electricity that you can hand out to those who haven't got that as fortunate as you. So the ones that are fortunate or could be fortunate are the council houses, the 6,500 that we got in Gloucester. Let's put some solar panels on them and let's put them fit for purpose. And then the excess energy can go into the schools, breakfast clubs, doctors, wherever. So you start small. But then what happens then? The private sector will want to know. And I mean, when I say the private sector, I mean those that are unfortunately in debt for the rest of their lives. Usually the Generation Z, no, where's these? Generation, whoever it is.
Millennials.
Now. Millennials, yeah. Yeah, poor millennials who suffered viciously for our greed, my generation's greed. So what do? Well, we build we give them hope. And that's what I'm saying. We give them jobs, decent jobs. Jobs where they're proud to work in. Jobs where they're building homes for the future, not just themselves, but they're for their children, with the knowledge that they'll never be in debt. Why would they be in debt? They've got energy, all right? They can turn the lights on and off when they want. They want to cook when they want. They can grow where they want, in their gardens, allotments, wherever. That's the world I want to live in. That's the country I want to live in. And we ain't going to do it. We know capitalism, or whatever you want to call this that we're in now for the last 60, 70 years, doesn't work. And I'm just saying, it can be another way.
Well, it does work for some.
You said some, not all.
Yeah, tiny.
I'm all the really, one. Yeah. I'm for the many.
So anyway, you've just stood in these local elections. Did you find that fun? Did you get a chance to debate with some of the other big parties?
No,
the big parties?
Not at that point. No, not with the councils. In the general, we had one hustings. I love talking. I love this sort of banter. You know what I mean? I'm part of Palestine Solidarity. We had that today, and I do that. And it's just dropping little pebbles in the water and making people think that it can be different. Because all I'm hearing is death, misery, and sorrow. That's here as well as obviously other parts of the world. And it doesn't have to be this way. Let's build houses, or decent houses. Let's keep our boys from fighting wars that we haven't got no need to be in, because it is for the some and not the many. And look after our own, and we'll be more. We got more in common that way with regards to homes than we have with anything else that these idiots talk about and claim to be doing, blaming each other rather than themselves. We got to wake up. We're the problem, all right? And until we come together, nothing's going to change. So that's why I'm part of a party that I hope, no to war, no to NATO, yes to housing.
You're saying we're the problem, but yeah. Actually the problem is, I mean, we had somebody called Jeremy Corbyn. Lots and lots of people at the higher-ups, you might call them, worked to stop him getting elected from within his own party and outside. The mass media, particularly people within his own party, steering him into a position which was going to get him less votes, but also discrediting him and destroying him from within. So what hope is there? I mean, and also, this, what I was trying to say is, it's not our fault that democracy seems to have been grabbed, taken over.
Once bitten, twice shy. Twice shy. That's all I'll say, okay? It ain't going to happen again. We know them, who they are. All right.
Well, okay, so, Steve, if people were interested in following your stuff online, etc., whereabouts?
Steve Gower on Facebook, Twitter, just Steve Gower. I'm wearing a flat cap. Look like, what's it called? What's that cap?
Steptoe,
is it? Yeah, wherever I've been called worse. What worse? Yeah, get me on... what's the other one? Yeah, all the social media bits, TikTok and
comments. X, that sort
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, I don't do a lot of X, but yeah, it's good.
Okay, so thanks ever so much for joining us. Go on.
The Blue Lantern Pilot Project. There's a website for that, bluelanternpilotproject.uk.org, I think.
.org.uk,
yeah, maybe. Whatever it is, yeah.
yeah, so I also asked Pierre, whilst he was on, I said, well, what happened to the yellow vests? Over in France, because we were quite sort of cheering them on here, from certainly on this show, and he explained very clearly what Macron did to kill them off.
Whatever happened to the yellow vests? Because in England we were looking across thinking, at last someone in Europe is doing something.
What happened? But don't forget that Macron did something absolutely horrible. He changed the heads of the préfecture de police, and he took some very violent guys, and they went up and they asked the cops to shoot on the yellow vest, so that we had I don't know, like 100, almost 200 people. They lost one eye, they lost one hand. They were in hospitals. It was extremely violent after that. And this is the violence of the police stopped the Yellow Jacket movement.
Right. Anyway, where do people find and follow you and get hold of your list? My listeners, I'm sure, would like to get your list.
Well, so they can follow me. They can follow me on Twitter. It's Pierre Jovanovic, with a C at the end. It's quite simple, but you can spell it for me because I'm not good.
That's
I'm
okay.
Not very good in English spelling.
No, do you have your own website?
Yeah. It's called Jovanovic.com and the press review is on the press review tab, so you will see it.
What about the list? Where is the list? We want the list.
It's on the book.
Where is the book?
The printer.
Well, let's hope so.
Just a reminder that Orwell was prophetic, because you in England, when I see that people just for a message on Facebook, on Instagram, they were thrown in jail, and by the same time you have people in the streets who are raping, stealing. This is weird, but this is totally, you are ahead of us in the Orwellian state. Seriously.
Okay, Pierre, thank you. Pierre, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for your kind attention. Thank you very much, Sonny.
So that's Pierre Jovanovic. And, so the full version of that is a pretty fascinating tale he tells. Particularly, he's very level-headed, considering he's just had this horrible police raid and they're trying to stop his book being distributed. They were trying to stop it being published, but it was already at the printers, so they kind of missed the mark. And as you can say, I will try and get a copy of the list. He's got a list of all of the criminals involved in the banking scandal, Martin, the 2008, and he's saying it was absolutely obvious. He's got all the emails now. They have the emails. The emails are out there. People at Goldman Sachs and other bankers saying to each other, we're going to move all these credit default swaps, etc., over.
I think it's not just him that's picked up on this criminality of the bankers. Obviously, that he's named names.
Well, he's got the evidence in the book, and he's got the names as well. So this is what this is why the police are getting a bit rattled over there. He points out in the interview as well, of course, that Macron was working for the Rothschild Bank during the time of the 2008 bailouts.
That's right. Well, there's a famous economist in the US.
We also had the cocaine issue this week. And if you saw that.
Yes, I did see that.
Was it cocaine, do you think, or not?
Well, I don't know, Tony, but I mean, we need to focus on credit default swaps when we come to cocaine afterwards, if you don't.
All right, go on then.
Yeah. James Galbraith is the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, who was a very famous economist, who wrote the famous books about the 1929 crash, and he was, he used to work for the US government. He's originally Canadian, but his son, James Galbraith, is based at the University of Austin in Texas, and he's also an economist. And he pointed out that what should happen when a banking crash like that happens is it's usually based on insider fraud, that basically it is fraudulent behavior. They know what they're doing. It's not an accident. And what should happen is what happened in the savings and loans crash in the 1980s when Reagan was in power was over 1,000 executives of the savings and loans institution were imprisoned and their assets were seized. What happened in 2008 is that the only person who went to prison for any of it was Bernie Madoff. And that's because he'd been ripping off very, very wealthy people and they got very mad at him. So he was made a scapegoat. But the whole system is, in fact, criminalised. Now, Tony just mentioned there about cocaine. And one of the things that happened in the 2008 crash, and there was a UN Office on Drugs and Crime, it's called. They made a report in 2009, and mostly the people in the UN Office on Drugs and Crime are police officers, and they said, well, in actual fact, what happened there was that there were two things that bailed out the bankrupt banks, which had been bankrupted deliberately, as we've been saying. One was the taxpayer, that means us, and the other was the drug cartels. Because they just immediately, because they're having a panic, we've got no money, we're about to go bust, and the drug cartels just approached the banks and said, you need some cash, don't you? They went, yes, yes, give us some cash. They said, well, we've got some, and they gave it to them. And of course, underpinning the whole of the Western financial system is fraud and drug dealing. And the drug dealing is orchestrated by the CIA, as anybody in Colombia will tell you. I was on the trade union delegation in Colombia in 2005. Pablo Escobar's son has been on the record of saying this, my father worked with the CIA. And, of course, the whole terrorist movement in Nicaragua, which killed 30,000 people, funded by cocaine. The war in Afghanistan to drive out the Russians was funded by heroin. And it was all protected by the intelligence services. And this is the base, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which went bankrupt. This is the Western banking system is absolutely riddled with criminality.
It is.
From top to bottom.
Absolutely right. And the City of London, Wall Street, etc. The book, Pierre Jovanovic's book, Jovanovic, Pierre, of course. His book is a French title, but it translates into English as follows. 2008, the year when every day the media and politicians lied to the citizens to hide the biggest heist in history, led by the global elite and crazy American bankers. Well, that will be an interesting one when it hits the bookshelves.
Well, I think the fact that the police are trying to close it down is a bit of an advert, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I hope it is, yeah. So anyway, also this week, of course, we've got the Rich List, the glorious Rich List. This is something which we, you know, we're very privileged to be friendly with Kevin Carhill, who's one of the original writers for Rupert Murdoch on the Sunday Times Rich List. Most of the articles about this today, this is obviously coming out on Sunday, they headline on King Charles, because he is one of the highest moving up individuals in the Rich List. Now, that's not a coincidence, is it?
No. I mean, and no doubt that it's a massive underestimation of his real wealth.
$640 million, so says the Rich List. But as we're about to hear from Kevin, it's nothing like that. In reality, as he said many times on this programme, back in the mid-1980s, the Rupert Murdoch got a phone call from the palace saying, we want you to take the Crown Estate off of the amount of money you say that Prince Charles then, Duchy of Cornwall, as it was the Queen at the time, controls. But Kevin is absolutely adamant that they have now said quietly, this is around about three or four, maybe I think it was during the Cameron Osborne administration, the Crown Estate is most definitely is the property, private personal property of the King and of the royal family. So let's have a listen to Kevin talking here, and also a lot about how much of this wealth is not taxed and hidden because it's put away in tax havens.
It's an incredible effort to find out who owns what in a British tax haven. Some of them have limited disclosure, but they don't tell you, you know, that Hinduja keeps $20 billion of his assets in the Cayman Islands. Nobody knows where those assets are. And the editor of the Sunday Times is estimating and guessing. The cost of trying to establish where the assets are, well, they don't have a budget anymore.
Well, okay, so the whole thing is, it sounds like a bit of a fiction.
Yeah, I got away with it because I was looking at funny, odd things, land, which was extremely difficult to establish in those days, and I was looking at the tax havens. But the cost of doing one tax haven, which was where the Guinness money was, it took months, cost a fortune. The Guinness family keep their assets in Switzerland. And, you know, one of them is the Duke of Ivy is mentioned in the rich list further down. But there's no indication of where his assets are held.
Now, for these people with the billions, the billionaires, the trillionaires, what about, I mean, how much tax do they pay?
In most cases, none. If your assets are held in a British tax haven, first of all, they're not disclosed. In most of the tax havens, the Caymans and British Virgin Islands, you cannot get disclosure. And most of the tax havens impose no tax at all. So the really rich never see a bailiff. And in any case, it's worth checking that you cannot, in notionally in British law, be prosecuted for debt. And bailiffs, in effect, are breaking the law. They're prosecuting for debt. And it's a perversion, another perversion of the system. And so far, there's no sign. The Inland Revenue told me a couple of months ago that the total losses to the United Kingdom by just four companies, Microsoft, Google, Apple, and Facebook Meta, to a dodge they use, they're using the Republic of Ireland as a tax dodge, and the United Kingdom loses, wait for this, 13 billion. And the revenue had its staff cut by the Tories, and the Tories effectively handicapped the Inland Revenue and didn't let them investigate the what's called the Irish double dip.
Well, it almost sounds medieval. It's like the king, the government are like kind of the Sheriff of Nottingham. But he does appear, doesn't he, this year in the rich list, King Charles, and he's doing quite well.
It's a guess. The private, you know, the private kind of shares and things of the king are not known. It's a guess estimate. Back when I was doing the rich list, you could talk to people at Barings Bank in particular, and you could get, not on the record, but you could at least get a reasonable estimate. I'm not sure the list even does that. But by ignoring what the Crown and the Duchy of Cornwall owns, it makes the list completely ridiculous. And I mean, Murdoch himself isn't on it. He, again, no one knows where he keeps his assets, but he's an American citizen and he spends an awful lot of time in the UK for, you know, a non-dom. But anyway.
So King Charles has increased his net worth by £5 billion. I mean, this is after he inherited everything from his mum with no tax, no inheritance tax at all. So he is doing quite well. Whereabouts do you think he should be on the list?
Well, going back to the original list, he should be at the top. The Crown Estate knocks out most of the top people on the list, and I think it's quite suspicious that all the people, or most of the people at the top of the list, are effective. Nobody knows where they live.
Well, he says they don't know where they. What Kevin means there is the passport status. Some of them have multiple passports. They move from country to country, Martin, whichever one is going to be the most convenient, so they don't pay tax.
Well, we know what's going on, and as we were saying in the 2008 crisis, what should have happened is lots of these people should have been sent to prison and their assets
Belarus,
should have been
by the
seized.
Way, Belarus doesn't recognise dual nationality. If you have a Belarusian passport and another passport, they don't recognise your other passport, only the Belarusian one. And so some countries see this whole idea of having dual citizenship as a kind of tax dodge, and they just simply say, no, you're not doing that.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the ways we could, in fact, get money out of the wealthy in this country is we just pass a rule that says it doesn't matter where you live. If you are a British citizen, you must pay tax on all of your assets. tell us what they are. And they say, well, we're not going to tell you what they are, but we'll estimate it for you. And if you want to argue with our estimation, you'll have to show us your accounts. And then we just say that outright, you pay us what we think you owe you, otherwise you lose your British citizenship, which means you lose your passport.
It seems to me that most of the sort of flavour of the Second World War seems to have gone now. The super rich are paying no tax, whilst, as we've just been hearing, tax, like council tax, is being imposed on people that have no money at all.
Well, the tax burden has been shifted onto the poor. Of course, what happened at the end of World War II, in order to fight the war, governments needed resources, so the top rates of tax went up to the, you know, the 95% in Britain and 96%, I believe, in the United States.
Well, they needed the people to fight for them as well, and so they needed to be fighting for something.
Well, that's right, and of course, that meant, of course, that in Britain we could build a national health service immediately the war was over. We could do it, because the tax rates... And of course, that's why we've got all these stately homes in this country in the hands of the National Trust, because people just couldn't pay the death duties and they had to hand it over to the National Trust.
Interesting, isn't it, that King Charles should be at the top of the list, and Kevin's saying they've just wangled it, basically, so he's somewhere down the list, and he's sort of shyly putting his hand in front of his face, I'm not so sure, you know, I've got quite a lot of money. Actually, he's got way more than everybody else, it seems, but he's trying to hide it. And actually, this is a lie, isn't it? This witch list is just a load of nonsense, to be honest with you.
Well, it's a guess. It's a guess, isn't it? I mean, did you remember...
But they don't tell you that. This is what they do. They have a list of them, and they don't say, well, actually, we don't really know what's going on, and X and Y and Z could be far completely different to what we're saying.
Well, I mean, did you remember we had Brian Eno in a clip the other week going on about Carlos Slim in Mexico, and somebody coming in and telling him that he'd slipped down the rich list and that he was no longer number 6, he was number 8 or something. He was having a panic, because there are some rich people who want to be in the rich list and to be seen to be in it, you know, the Elon Musk and what have you. But I imagine that Semyon Mogilevich, who's the head of the Russian mafia, quite likely richer than any of those people, but he's not on the list because he's a mafiosi.
Well, so much is all these roads head back to Tampon Charlie, the wife murdering king. And one of those slight problems that he's had recently is Prince Harry has managed to grab the spotlight a little bit, like his mum used to do all the time. I'm sure this is irking King Charles, because Charles is refusing to speak to Harry because Harry has decided he wants to have some sort of police protection, which I thought was completely normal as one of the heirs to the throne, and also the son of the king and the brother of the heir apparent. You would have thought you'd have a bit of police protection, but no, we're not having any of that, and because you want it, I'm never going to speak to you. So this came out last week, actually, with Prince Harry saying, look, I just want my dad to talk to me.
The Duke of Sussex has told the BBC he wants reconciliation with the King and royal family, as he doesn't know how long his father has got left. Prince Harry was speaking after the High Court rejected his appeal against the decision to significantly downgrade the security he's entitled to when visiting the UK. He'd argued he'd been singled out for unjustified and inferior treatment by the decision taken when he stepped back from royal duties in 2020. Three judges decided his sense of grievance didn't translate into a legal argument. In an exclusive interview in Los Angeles with our correspondent Neda Tofik, Prince Harry claimed his father wouldn't speak to him because of the legal case, and he said he was devastated to have lost his appeal.
I can't see a world in which I would be bringing my wife and children back to the UK at this point. And the things that they're going to miss is, well, everything. You know, I love my country. I always have done, despite what some people in that country have done. So, you know, I miss the UK. I miss parts of the UK. Of course I do. And I think that it's really quite sad that I won't be able to show, you know, my children my homeland.
What do you say to those who ask, why should the taxpayer pay for your police security if you have your own private security?
If you know that other people are being protected, people that have made a choice for public office, then why wouldn't you be comfortable, happy with someone in my position who's given 35 years service to his country, two tours of Afghanistan, and the threats and risks to my life? I was born into this position. I was born into those risks, and they've only increased over time. I can't be a private citizen. I will never be seen as a private citizen. I will never be treated as a private citizen. not by the media, not by most people, and certainly not by anybody that wants to harm me or my wife or our kids.
How are you feeling about this decision?
Firstly, I'm devastated. Not so much as devastated as with the loss that I am about the people behind the decision. There have been so many disagreements, differences between me and some of my family. This current situation that has been ongoing for 5 years with regard to human life and safety is the sticking point. It is the only thing that's left. Of course, some members of my family will never forgive me for writing a book. Of course, they will never forgive me for lots of things. But, you know, I would love reconciliation with my family. There's no point in continuing to fight anymore. As I said, life is precious. I don't know how much longer my father has. He won't speak to me because of this security stuff. But it would be nice to reconcile.
I suppose this is why, I know you don't like these royal stories, Martin, but it's a bit heartbreaking. Harry's there saying, I just want Dad to speak to me. He won't speak to me.
Well, that's between him and his dad, isn't it? If he doesn't want to speak to him,
like
I can't
make
it.
Are they just like any old family?
Sorry?
Are they just like any other family?
Well, it looks like it, doesn't it? Yeah, I mean, it's first world problems, is what I'd say.
I think it's called The Family, isn't it? Or The Firm. Yes. And Harry's not in it.
Well, no. And, of course, an awful lot of...
Is he King Charles's son? Or is he Charles Hewitt's son?
I don't know, Tony. I mean, there's lots of suspicions that he's actually Captain Hewitt's boy. But, well, I don't know. I've no idea.
One of the things that Harry's always saying is, I just want the truth. So I think he's, you know, it does seem to me that he's doing everything he can to force the royals, the British press, to acknowledge that he's not been treated very well. Maybe Meghan Markle wasn't going to be the best choice, but that's none of their business. She's not necessarily made things better for them. But anyway, you know, I just find it amazing that you get these kind of pettiness going on at this level with King Charles.
Well, it's not that amazing. I mean, this is a soap opera which keeps, you know, many journalists.
It's a real family.
It's a real family with real problems.
Yeah. I think it reflects extremely badly on the character of the king that he doesn't want to talk to his son. Maybe the king knows that it's not really his son. Who knows? So the implications here are that we've got a dysfunctional firm. The richest people in Britain, and they are running a show which is getting away with billionaires are getting away with paying no tax, while the tax is something very medieval. It's like Robin Hood, Sheriff of Nottingham style thing in Britain at the moment.
Well, that's right, and it's because it is medieval. I mean, the inherited power of the royal family comes from the medieval era, comes from the 1066 and William the Conqueror and all the rest of it, and it's still there. Of course, well, it is. It hasn't gone away.
It seems to have come back, actually.
It never went away.
It did go away. Rubbish. You really annoy me, actually, when you say, you make out that we've had this terrible, terrible country. Actually, the country we grew up in wasn't very good for people abroad, although the empire was falling apart at that point, and actually it was quite good. They were getting rid of the Brits. But it was that we had, as Steve was saying earlier, as a teenager, it was possible for him to walk straight out and have his own home.
Yes.
Not anymore.
In other words, things were managed better in that particular era, the Trente Glorieux, as they called them in France, from 1945 to 1973. But of course, it was quite nice for people in this country.
What about 1980, Thatcher?
Yeah, well, that's exactly the turning point. Yeah. We start, the ruling class, Kaletsky, the Polish English economist, pointed out in the 1950s, he said, well, this system works very well. The rich pay quite a lot of tax, but they're basically all right. They've got nothing to moan about. And everybody else gets healthcare and so on. And trade unions are strong. What really changed from the 80s onwards is that As productivity rose year on year, as it should do in a capitalist economy, wages rose as well. So real wages rose year on year. You might not have been able to afford a car in 1960, but by 1964 you could. And of course, you expected that to carry on. But from 1980s onwards, all of the benefits of productivity increases have gone to the shareholders of private companies, not to the workers,
which is why it gradually soars through the banks we're all sitting on. Quantitative easing, when the Bank of England starts printing money, that also went to the shareholders and to the owners of assets than to the people. Anyway, one of the economists that looks at this from time to time is a guy called Phil Bevin, and he's... I'm not sure if he's sort of political affiliations, but anyway, he's a very good writer. And I spoke to him last week about this whole relationship between Britain and America. He is suggesting, in fact, he's absolutely adamant that Britain owns and controls a far greater amount of what happens in the United States, property, assets of all sorts, than anyone realises.
I'm trying to prove a case through... primary source evidence and kind of mainstream stuff. So when I'm looking at the US empire, such as it is, I'm looking for, what does the US empire, what does the US actually own? Well, if you look at the figures in terms of land ownership, well, the US government doesn't actually own all of its own territory because of the way ownership works, what I was talking about. Quite a lot of it is privately held. By oligarchs, really, not by ordinary people. Most of it's held by oligarchs. And so, okay, so the US doesn't actually have much in the way of land assets. Okay, so what about other assets, financial assets? Well, if you look at the dollar trade, for instance, I think Wall Street trades around 17 to 19% of the world dollar trade. It processes that. City of London does 38 to 44%. So City of London trades twice as many dollars as the United States itself does. And if you take into account the ownership laws and rules around Britain and the Crown territories, that means that at any one point in time, the King of England owns more dollars than the US government.
Well, yeah, but what does that actually prove in terms of day-to-day power? Surely the Americans are, you know, a massive military. They're projecting influence and power around the world, where the Britain is a kind of, we're a has-been, aren't we? Let's be frank about it.
What you're proposing here is you're looking at it from the point of view of individual nation states. And as a nation state, the United States is incredibly powerful. Well, at least, you know, that's the way it appears. But I'm talking about an international empire, which goes back hundreds of years, and you know, the kind of the, I think a good definition of an empire is a state that is made up of an imperial state that's made up of a number of different nations, and so if you're looking at, say, the Crown today. You're looking at the territories of Great Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and various other places across the world as tax havens and things. But territorially, and this is territory literally owned by the King of England, you're looking at a sixth of the Earth's land surface. Now, if you compare that to the territories owned by the United States, the United States doesn't actually own very much at all. It's piddling. It's nothing. And this isn't actually my working out. I should reference Kevin Cahill, who was a researcher in the House of Lords and also was a researcher for the Sunday Times Rich List. So he's a mainstream guy who knows what he's talking about. And also I've checked this out. And literally, yes, the King of England owns a sixth of the Earth's land surface. You're also talking about most of the world's dollar supply. And in terms of the way the Federal Reserve works, just to unpack that a bit, is that the Federal Reserve is essentially, it's a private bank. There's a certain percentage that US banks within the Federal Reserve system and their private banks have to put aside to essentially bankroll the Federal Reserve. And so the US government is dependent on very much on private finance. And if there isn't much growth in the financial system, then there's less money to go around. And in terms of international finance, the entity that has, well, the entities that have the most leverage in international finance are the Bank of England and the City of London. And it's also worth pointing out that a lot of, as I mentioned earlier, that a lot of US land is privately owned by oligarchs. Where are they storing their wealth? Well, I don't know for certain, but I would hazard an educated guess that their investments follow the general trend, which would be, you know, between 38% and 44% stored in London or registered tax havens. And we don't know exactly how much really is stored in British tax havens because we don't have the figures. So basically you're looking at the United States, most of its assets are almost certainly, and actually the other thing with the United States, it's foreign held debt. People talk about the Japan and China owning being the biggest owners of US debt. That's not true. The largest owner by far of US debt, international debt, is the Crown. And that's all you have to do is add up the Crown territories that hold large amounts of US debt. The Cayman Islands holds a surprisingly large amount. So in terms of US debt, in terms of international holders of US debt, the Crown is the biggest. And so basically the US is pretty much mostly owned, I think, or to a large extent owned by the Crown. And if you think also about the Federal Reserve and US debt, the other, when we take international debt and other international countries out of the equation, the biggest holder of US debt is actually the private sector. And again, and like what I said earlier, when it comes to the private sector, I expect that the investments follow the general trend, which means the Crown probably has a controlling share in that as well.
So, like I say, all roads lead back to Highgrove House, to Buckingham Palace. What he's saying there, Martin, is interesting little factoids, like that more dollars are traded by the City of London than by Wall Street every day.
That wouldn't surprise me at all, because what happened with the City of London is during the 1970s, the euro-dollar market was based in the City of London. And in fact, it was the Soviet Union that started putting its money into, its dollar holdings into London, because they didn't want the Americans to seize them. And that then created the possibility for the City of London to lend those dollars on, which were called euro dollars. And of course, and the City of London also has got much laxer regulations than Wall Street. So all the kinky stuff that you want to do in Wall Street, you can't do it in Wall Street, you do it in the City of London. And of course, the City of London and Wall Street and the oligarchy, the Anglo-American oligarchy, think about Cecil Rhodes, think about, the Rhodes scholarships and all the rest of it. These have been integrated elites for a long time. Boris Johnson's father is an American. He was born in America. Winston Churchill was married into an American family. The elite in the West is an intermarried multinational elite. Look at somebody like Murdoch, born in Australia, lived in Britain, and is now a US citizen. These people are not British. They are international aristocrats.
Oligarchs.
Indeed.
So that's Phil Bevin, you just heard. I'll put the full version of that up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. His blog is called A Different Narrative. He's there on Patreon. But, I mean, one of the most staggering claims he's making there is that the Crown owns the United States.
Well, you'd have to ask Kevin Kyle about this, because, of course, they own lots and lots of land in Canada as well. And, it's a big can of worms. And of course, it's not even sure that King Charles even knows what he owns. You know, I mean, it's so massive that it's probably just ticking over.
He's got some sort of wealth managers that are beavering away, making sure that he becomes the owner of everything, basically. But I can always remember having a chat to a friend, someone, I won't name him, but someone you know as well, Martin, got to know quite well during the 9/11 years. And he was telling me how he'd had conversations. I mean, we just heard Kevin saying how in the 1980s that the Sunday Times people used to ring up Barings Bank and have off the record chats about how much was in various bank accounts at Barings, and very much off the record, and that would never ever be told as part of the rich list. But our mutual friend was saying that he had contacts at Coutts Bank, who are the royal bankers, and that the royal family owned massive amounts of United States property and assets in the United States, masses of it. And of course, if you go back sort of 200-300 years, you can see, you know, how this is all much of the build up of the United States, the initial building of all these cities, the industry in the late 1800s, early 1900s in the United States. This was all funded from Britain.
Well, that's right. There's been a struggle. I mean, during the American Civil War, Abraham Lincoln started printing what were called greenbacks. So instead of borrowing money from Wall Street or from the City of London to fight the war, they printed their own money. And some people think that's possibly what led to his assassination at the end of the war. And of course, the you know, some of our colleagues like Webster Tarpley will be very much of the opinion that what happened in the United States is they had a revolution, they kicked the British out, but the British came back in by controlling the financial aspects of what was going on. And that's a kind of, if you like, American nationalist perspective. But my view is that this is an internationally integrated elite. So it doesn't make much sense to talk about it as being British or American. They all go to the same schools and the same parties.
It's almost like a cult. The idea is you just keep really secretive about everything. You don't tell anyone what you're up to. You make sure you hide everything, and you certainly don't pay any tax. Anyone that does is a ninny. Also this week there was a terrific interview. Several of you sent me this, and eventually I looked at it. Brilliant little interview with Catherine Austin Fitz, who was, I think, wasn't she, Martin, involved in the US government at one point with responsibility for some big budgets in the US. Is that right?
I can't remember much about her apart from the fact that she's, you know, she used to work in Wall Street, I think. So she's well connected. You know, she's a knowledgeable person.
Yeah, and she was on the Jimmy Dore show this week talking about the disaster that the U.S. economy is.
The heart of the problem is the American people, 325 million people, spend a lot of time and money trying to change people in the boxes, thinking that swinging the boxes back and forth between the either party is going to get us someplace. And that does, you know, that will get us incremental places. But if we want change, we're going to have to fundamentally change, you know, in our daily lives, where we put our time, where we put our money, who we support, how we support. And, you know, if tomorrow everybody pulled their money out of the banks that did the mortgage fraud, did the missing money, if everybody pulled their, you know, take every stock that is guilty of murdering kids with pharmaceutical products and all these games. If we just called, if everyone called their broker and said, you know something, get all of that out of my portfolio. I want nothing to do with them.
That's what I've actually done that. I've actually done that. Right. I put my money in gold. Go ahead.
If we simply exercised all the powers of shunning, I mean, if everybody called up, you know, if you have a university who's doing shenanigans in their endowment, we called them and said, you know, that's it. I'm not supporting you. If we shifted our time and our money, you know, especially the most important thing everybody listening to this can do is completely re-engineer your food, your water, and your preventative health so that you walk away from all these healthcare systems because they're dangerous and they lie. And started to support, you know, doctors like Mary. You know, the world is full of great doctors and great healthcare practitioners who are telling you the truth. Let's support them. So if we want to shift the boxes, voting for somebody in the uniparty or getting somebody appointed You know, when you're in the box, you're under control. I was in the box. I got fired. I got fired because I refused to break the law. They ordered me to break the law. I refused. I got fired.
So if someone like Mary Talley would actually become in the box, she would also get fired, or she'd have
Mary would get fired within 60 days, or she'd be dead, or they'd kill somebody in her family. I mean, it would be very dangerous. I mean, John F. Kennedy tried to change the model. He got shot. So every president who's tried, so let's look at the biggest financial fraud in the government. Can you guess what the biggest financial fraud is?
You know, I would point to the Pentagon, but I'm guessing there's a bigger one, right?
So we have $36 trillion of debt. You know why?
Why?
Because we issue the currency with debt based. We can just issue the currency, right?
Right.
Debt. Right. Why do we have $36 trillion of debt? We just issued the currency. So Lincoln tried to do that. He ended up dead. You know, Andrew Jackson tried to cancel the central bank. They tried to assassinate him. He beat the rap, right? Kennedy had started to propose that we issue greenbacks. You know, he had started to set up issuing greenbacks. No debt-based currency. Boom. He's dead. Right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So I've never had anybody who could actually explain to me. They've explained it to me, and I still never understood what they were saying. And I just thought I was, because I was dumb. It's like, why, if we can print the money, why do we have to borrow the money? We're printing it and we're borrowing it? That doesn't make any sense.
Right. So you don't. You can just issue the currency. So if you come to Solari, there's a story of Guernsey. Guernsey, at one point really needed to, you know, build a seawall and do all sorts of infrastructure, and they had no money. So instead of borrowing, they just decided to print, you know, make up their own currency and issue it. And of course, it created lots of economic activity, and they built the infrastructure they needed to have a much stronger economy. It was a huge success. I think the problem with the dollar is not that it's fiat. The greatest currencies in the history of the world have been fiat currencies that had great governance systems. I think our problem is it's debt-based, and I think our problem is we have a secret governance system and that is very much out of alignment with the general population. And, you know, whether it's they're poisoning us or they're poisoning us financially, you know, the history of central banking is anytime a civilization legalizes usury, it's only a matter of time until it fails. And if you look at the financial system, we have legalized usury and the amount of money that's being siphoned out of people's pockets by financial. I just saw a great, I don't know if you've ever interviewed Alan Collange, who runs one of the most effective organizations trying to stop all the terrible things going on in student loans. And he just put out a series of graphics. We're going to put them out on our social media that shows how much debt is going to be collected in each state from people, from students in that state, how much interest they're taking out on student loans of the, you know, per state, and how that compares to the state budget. And Jimmy, it's absolutely frightening. I mean, they've got the whole, you know, they've got the whole, you pick any state, they've got the whole tax basis in a debt trap. It's unbelievable. And now the federal government has said on the Department of Education loans, they're going to enforce against those kids. And that means they're going to garnish wages. They're going to garnish Social Security. This is going to be very, very ugly.
Catherine was telling me this is the, she wanted to send me the dangers of being stung by a bee. I guess what that's this is about, or, oh, I'm sorry. No.
So this is, the Bank of International Settlements is the central bank of central banks.
The Bank of International Settlements, which people have no idea what that bank is. And it's basically like its own country. Nobody controls it, but it controls all our money, right?
It has sovereign immunity, and it coordinates the top 63 central banks, and it's leading a process in many different countries through something called innovation hubs to institute central bank digital currency. And in 2020, Augustine Carsons, who's the general manager of the BIS, was speaking in an IMF panel and explained why he likes CBDCs. Okay, so, so this
is the head of the Bank of International Settlements, which controls is at the top of the chain of all the central banks in the world, and he's going to tell you why he likes central digital banking currencies.
And before you start, let me just say, because they have sovereign immunity, they have the power to move money globally and keep it on their balance sheet in secret.
So that's a little bit about the Bank for International Settlements. Extremely dodgy lot, Martin. They're also a sovereign country. Sovereign, they say it's got sovereign immunity. So even though it's based in Basel in Switzerland, the Swiss police, they might find themselves getting shot or arrested if they try and cross the threshold.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair summary of the situation. She was mentioning greenback dollars, yeah, that Kennedy was talking about doing that. Essentially the government creating money rather than the private bankers. And that's exactly how they funded the Union side in the Civil War. And that's what Lincoln brought in. And, of course, they could have carried on doing that at the end of the Civil War. But Lincoln was assassinated, and they went back to borrowing money from the private banks. And, of course, this has always been hanging over capitalism, is the possibility of just getting rid of private banks altogether.
She's also talking about usury and the debt trap. So the idea is that people, once they're in debt, basically controlled by the banks and the bankers.
Well, that's right. I mean, look at all the developing countries now. They're all in debt to private banking system, and then when they default, they get the IMF lend them money, but then basically they then determine your policy. So that's happened in Latin America, in Africa, and now with Trump and his tariffs, they won't be able to pay those debts, and they're going to go down. I would suggest something like Argentina is going to default. Now, if Argentina defaults, that will crash the banking system.
We're sitting in a situation, aren't we, both in the Middle East, in Ukraine, various other situations, Martin, where this is just about sitting on. It's almost like it's wobbling. It's a bit like the Italian job, you know, the coach in the Italian job. It's wobbling on the edge there. If you move, the thing might go over the cliff.
Yes, it probably will go over the cliff. And, of course, if it's going to go over the cliff, they may decide to push it because they can make money on what's happening.
But BBC isn't really keeping us informed about all this, is it? And it was amazing this week. I don't know if you saw this. Oh, by the way, I'll put Catherine Austin Fitz and Jimmy Dore up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. Very interesting full interview there. We had Tim Davey, ex-marketing executive at PepsiCo, who's now the director general at the BBC, telling us all about the crisis in trust in Britain. Well, the BBC seems to me, I mean, I was watching this, I think it was Tuesday this week, absolutely incredulous that he could have the cheek to be complaining about the crisis in trust when the BBC are largely responsible for it.
Well, they're one of the things that's responsible for it. They're definitely a brick in the wall, aren't they?
Anyway, let's have a listen to a bit of his speech this week. Really, I think what's going on here is they are angling for more money from us as part of the new licence fee settlement. So let's have a listen to Tim Davey, the guy from Pepsi, who is now in charge of editorial at the BBC.
We need a charter that allows us to act faster, be more agile and respond to the changing market, technology and audience needs. One which allows the BBC to extend our partnerships with other PSBs and enables the BBC and other UK players to build scale together. When it comes to funding, we are not asking for the status quo. We want modernisation and reform. But in doing so, we must safeguard universality. All the funding models that are being floated in the debate have their merits and drawbacks. But some, such as advertising or subscription, don't pass the test of building a universal, trusted public service. Beyond that, we keep an open mind and we continue to actively explore all options that can make our funding model fairer, more modern and more sustainable. When it comes to funding the world service, we do need help. There's never been a more important time to invest in this priceless national asset. We believe the UK should be ambitious about its future, and the government should invest for significant growth, not survival. Now, there are other critical areas where we're calling for enlightened policy interventions to support the UK's world-class creative industries and build trust. There has been a lot said and written recently about the funding crisis facing the TV production sector. We want to see increased incentives for UK production, including tax credits. It's a system that's proven to work, but it should be reformed and extended to support key and at-risk genres, as well as to incentivize public service media objectives like encouraging production outside London, telling local stories, and preserving IP within the UK. We also need, critically, to see robust implementation of the Media Act at pace to secure good PSB prominence on every platform. If people can't find our services and prominence is simply secured by the highest bidder, then we can't build connections and trust. I know Ofcom are on the case. The stakes are very high and we need rapid, bold intervention.
So can't carry on with that. It's just so diabolical. I mean, you can listen to the guy and you know why there are desperate problems at the BBC. They're still doing their very best, and in fact, in many ways, better than other broadcasters. But he's using all this jargon there, even though it's all being broadcast around the world on BBC World. When he said, when he talks about IP, he means independent productions. When he talks about PSB, that's public sector,
public service
broadcasters, around, that is to say, state broadcasting, basically, mainly, or else charity-funded things, which are being defunded by Trump at the moment. But the main problem is the BBC is part of this, effectively, a military-industrial complex, which is telling us that wrong is right. I think you mentioned to me, didn't you? You sent me the email about hyper-normalisation the other day, and I was watching that film, and it's quite obvious that they're pushing a version of reality that's unhinged. It's not really what a lot of what the BBC and other broadcasters are doing is they're trying to sell us this kind of idea of toxic positivity. Hey, this is fine, when actually it's all falling to bits. So they have lost connection with reality, it seems to me.
Well, I mean, the way the BBC reports economics matters, it's, you know, it's a certain section of the news, isn't it, where people just switch off and they go on about, you know, and that what they do is what's called Simon Wren-Lewis calls media macro. So they basically simplify it so that the dummies can understand that the government's got to balance.
But
the books,
nobody can understand that, really. That was management gobbledygook.
Well,
coming out
indeed,
with
indeed.
You find your head just switching off. Like, is this written by AI?
Yes. Well, I mean, the point about that is he's using that gobbledygook because he's got to use the gobbledygook to explain to the people he's trying to persuade to give him more money that he is in touch with the markets and all the rest of it.
Why there's a crisis of trust, because you're speaking gobbledygook. You're supposed to be Director General of the BBC.
Well, I mean, as you know, Director Generals of the BBC used to be very independent minded, and they had their own little empire. But of course, they've been brought to heel years ago. I mean, after the financial crisis in 2008, I don't know if you came to it, where the BBC ran a big debate up in Filton, and they asked loads of people to come and say, how are we going to deal with the crisis? And it was a totally, totally biased presentation. So they had a suitcase full of thousands of pounds, which apparently everybody in Britain owed to the banks, and how were we going to pay it? And then they just opened the debate of how are we going to pay this debt? Now, of course, if you know anything about economics, you don't have to pay the debt. Yeah, so they'd frame the whole debate in terms of how do we pay this debt, and the answer is you don't have to pay it. But of course, that's what Steve Simon Wren-Lewis calls media macro. Most people don't really understand basic economics, so they can be bamboozled by this kind of gobbledygook.
Well, if he was to stop gaslighting us and bamboozling us, maybe there wouldn't be a crisis of trust in this country, and the various problems with government and other big agencies, press, media, etc. Finance, it might be possible to sort them out. We're going to take a break now, afterwards come back to look at a couple of new books, one by Dr. Vernon Coleman, and what's the other one? Oh, David Livingstone has just come out with a new book too.
I'm not these mist-covered mountains are home now for me. When home is the lowlands, and always will be. Someday you return to your valleys and your farms, and you no longer burn to be prisoners in arms. Through these fields of destruction, baptisms of fire, I've witnessed your suffering as the battle reached higher, and the needed happiness for that. In the fear and the alarm, you did not desert me, my brothers and I.
every leaf on every tree, every sand dune in the desert, every pile we never see. There is a deeper weight than this swelling in the world. There is a deeper weight than this. Listen to me, girl. Feel it rising in the cities. Feel it sweeping over land, over borders, over frontiers. Nothing will its power stand. I say, there is no deeper weight than this rising in the world. There is no deeper weight than this. Listen to me, girl. Of the fury, all the angels, all the devils, all around us, can't you see? There is a deeper way than this rising in the night. There is a deeper way than this, nothing will withstand. I say the is the seventh wave. I say the is the seventh wave. I say the is the seventh wave. I say the.
So a bit of homage to Police and Sting here, as you might have guessed. I just think it's the sort of stuff we don't hear on the radio, hardly anything. Very, very little BBC local radio. It's lovely to hear a bit of Sting, and particularly these two songs you've heard. In fact, all of those songs have got a bit of a sort of spiritual angle to them. So, including The Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits, which is also about people finding themselves fighting and killing people that they would much rather be sitting down and having a pint with, Martin.
Well, yes. Pop music, eh? Changes the world.
But it is not happening anymore. This is all... Actually, I should say, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. And the music there was The Spirits in the Material World, 1981, from The Police. Then we had Dire Straits, Brothers in Arms, which is the title song of the album, even though it's the last song on the album. That's 1985. And then we have Love is the Seventh Wave from Sting after he's left The Police, also 1985. The main piece of news this week, Martin, has got to be, you messaged it to me. Thank you, listeners, if you've sent that to me as well. But Martin was the one that sent me it on SMS, was this amazing story. Do you want to just introduce it in the Middle East Eye?
We're talking about Elon Musk's AI. Is that what we're talking about?
Nope. It's a secret meeting.
Oh, a secret
meeting. At the British Museum.
Oh, yes. Well, what's happened this week is on the anniversary of the Nakba, or of course the Israeli Declaration of Independence.
Which is actually the Nakba means
catastrophe.
Because it was a catastrophe.
It was a catastrophe for the Palestinians.
For hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. I mean, I don't know quite. This is back in 1948.
Yes. And of course, they declared their independence before it was recognised, and then they seized as much land as possible.
I mean, it's worth saying something about this whole shenanigans, because we've learned on this programme, I've learned, as we learn, you learn, folks, that the Mr. Viktor Rothschild played a very important role in making sure that the Russians and associated powers, we're talking about the Soviet Union, voted at the United Nations for the creation of the State of Israel. Now, you might say, well, this is a big American-British project, why we're not going to vote for it? But no, Viktor Rothschild managed to persuade them to. On the other side of the Atlantic, Nelson Rockefeller, who was in the State Department at the time, and he was in charge of South American affairs, he managed to get the South American countries to vote for it too. And they put an ultimatum to Ben-Gurion, saying, if you want your country, you're going to have to give up on any kind of vengeance on the Nazis after the war. So this is one of the reasons why the kidnapping of Adolf Eichmann in Buenos Aires and the shipping of him in a Bristol Britannia over to Israel by the Mossad in the 1960s, I think, Martin?
Yeah.
Was the only real retribution officially from Israel. There probably was a little bit more against the Nazis. But to be frank, we're being asked for many, many years to think that the Israel was like the complete antithesis of Nazism. And we're finding now that actually the Nazis were only really interested in sending to concentration camps the Jews that hadn't gone already as part of the Zionist program to Israel, which is pretty shocking, really.
It is. I mean, obviously, there's a lot to unpack there, and people, because of the internet now, people can find out a lot of things that were previously rather obscure about the creation of the State of Israel. But
so what effectively Hitler managed to do is he said anybody who agrees with Zionism and this idea of going to Palestine, we will help you go there, and anyone that doesn't, we're going to kill you. So this is, I mean, if you think about it, the Nazis did occupy almost all of Europe.
Well, I mean, they did, and of course, as Ken Livingstone had to resign from the Labour Party for pointing out the cooperation between the Zionists and the Nazis. There was even a medal, commemorating their cooperation, which was, they made a medal with a Star of David on one side and a swastika on the other. And of course, the Jabotinskyite right wing in Israel used to hang around with Mussolini. And, you know, that's Likud was modelled on the Italian Fascist Party.
So it was called the Havara Agreement. But anyway, this is all quite important when we're understanding what the Nakba actually was and why it was called a catastrophe even back in 1948.
Well, that's right. But what happened this week is the British Museum in London told the regular staff that they were going to have a corporate event on and they should all go home early, so they did. And the corporate event turned out to be the Israeli embassy's party celebrating the creation of the State of Israel, and they invited Kemi Badenoch, Nigel Farage and Angela Eagle, who's a minister in the current government, was representing the Labour Party at this jolly event where they celebrated the expulsion of the Palestinians and the murder of thousands of
them. And the warm-up act, another one invited, was Jimmy Carr.
Yes.
Who, I don't know if anyone's seen it, but someone was filming him as he was walking out of the venue. Jimmy, why were you doing this? Do you support the genocide? Blah, blah, blah. And he just walked off. He wasn't turning around as if he hadn't heard them.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it was a secret event, but of course...
Not really a stand-up comedian, is he?
Well, I mean, I don't know enough about him to have a strong opinion, apart from he did make a very off-colour remark, to say the least, when he said... you know, people say that Hitler was a bad guy for killing all the Jews, and of course he shouldn't have killed the Jews, but at least he killed the gypsies. And he came out with that. And
they thought this meeting was...
And he really had to apologise for it, but I mean, you know...
He's not apologised, he's back there again. He's doing the warm-up act for a genocide party.
That's right. But of course he thought it was okay to say it was okay to kill the gypsies. Now, if you said that about, oh, it was okay Hitler killing the Jews... But if you say,
he's got a funny sense of humour, isn't he?
Well, it's basically a racist sense of humour, isn't it? Oh. Yeah.
It's
maybe
evil.
The Roma should be given a land of their own.
It's not just a dark sense of humour at all.
The Roma should have a land of their own, and I think it should be,
Romania.
Mm. Well,
a Labour defence minister, anyway, you're quite right, Tuesday night boasted about a UK military support for Israel at this clandestine event at the British Museum. Does it make any difference that it's the British Museum and not somewhere like an embassy, the Israeli embassy?
Well,
or
I think what the Middle East Eye was suggesting is the British Museum ought to hold a progressive, you know, it's got a reputation for being a progressive institution, and maybe they shouldn't have rented out their premises to this, you know, cheerleading event for genocide.
It was authorised by the Israeli embassy to celebrate the anniversary of the 77th Independence Day for Israel. Is the independence of Israel something to celebrate?
Well, they obviously think it is, but the Palestinians not so much, since it's their country that's been taken off them.
Also, let's have a listen now to a little clip. I think it was filmed clandestinely, so may not be 100% clear, of Maria Eagle, UK Minister for Defence Procurement and Industry, speaking at this secret event at the British Museum this week.
As a long-standing friend and partner, it's been hard over the last couple of years to see Israel go through some of the most difficult times in its history. The appalling, unconscionable attacks on the 7th of October are still seared into our minds. The UK stood with Israel, with the RAF conducting surveillance flights over the Eastern Mediterranean in support of hostage rescue efforts. We stood with Israel when Iran launched its reckless, coordinated missile and drone attacks, with RAF aircraft intercepting a number of them. And we continue to stand with Israel today, supporting the right to security and the right of all Israelis to live free from fear and violence. On Israel's birthday, my thoughts also remain with all the hostages held still in Gaza. There's absolutely no justification for their continued detention, and we call for their unconditional release. And we want to see the humanitarian situation improve. What we hope for and are working for is a deal that brings a stop to the fighting, enables the release of all hostages, gets the aid flowing, and establishes a political horizon with credible and an irreversible path to peace.
So that's her ladyship, appointed by Tampon Charlie to be a minister of the crown, Maria Eagle, that is UK Minister for Defence, Procurement and Industry, speaking at the British Museum at this secret meeting, saying that there's no justification for holding the hostages, for example.
Well, I mean, I couldn't quite hear exactly
what she said. There's no justification for holding hostages.
Well, this hostages that was released this week, yeah, because of the negotiations directly between Hamas and the Trump administration. He had a US passport, this guy that was released, but he's actually an Israeli soldier. So he's not a hostage, he's a prisoner of war. And he's been very well treated, as all the hostages, prisoners of war, have been. The only people they're holding now are, in fact, military personnel. Meanwhile, of course, there are thousands and thousands of Palestinians of all ages being held in appalling conditions in concentration camps, where they are being raped, electrocuted, starved, and when they're released, they are absolutely skeletal. So there we are. The double standard is absolutely sickening, and quite a people around the world can see it. They can see what's going on. The Western media are feeding their publics a very bowdlerised version of the truth. But, of course, in places like South Africa and Brazil and China, they're, and India, for example, people are seeing quite a different, picture.
She's also defending the surveillance flights for the genocide that the British taxpayers paying for with the RAF.
Well, that's right, because the RAF have been overflying Gaza on behalf of the of the Israelis. We've also, the Akrotiri base has been used to supply weaponry to the Israelis from the United States. We also participated in this little war that we've just had with Yemen, where the RAF were involved in that. And of course, that has been very interesting development this week. Two aircraft carriers have been defeated by the Nasrallah forces, and they're going to carry on attacking Israel, but the Americans are not going to attack them, because they're basically about to lose. I think that's very interesting that two aircraft carriers have been defeated. They've had to go. Yeah, they couldn't carry on fighting. And if they go to war with Iran, Russia or China, all those aircraft carriers, our aircraft carrier, the Prince of Wales, is now threading through the Red Sea to go to Diego Garcia to join our other one, so for the attack on Iran. Maybe if it comes to a fight, all these aircraft carriers are going to be sunk with everybody on board. And maybe if you're going to come around killing people's children, they may want to kill some of your sailors.
So this business at the British Museum, the other thing to say about it is the BBC haven't reported it at all. In fact, none of the other London media, only the Middle East Eye, who it is believed is funded by Qatar.
Funded by the Qataris, yeah.
So why is this? I mean, this is megaly important. It's a secret meeting. It's a bit of investigative journalism. Various ministers are saying it's okay to support genocide. Why is the London media turning a blind eye to this?
Because they're controlled. That's why you can find out about it on our little show, or if you read Middle East Eye, you'll have found out about it. Otherwise, you're none the wiser.
See, I mean,
you?
I think. I mean, there's been also this week. I mentioned briefly the cocaine episode. I don't know if you saw the footage on the train with Macron and Mertz. Actually, Starmer was coming into the room at the time, so it didn't look like he necessarily, but it certainly did look like somebody, a media professional, had managed to get hold of the original footage taken by the Associated Press or one of the, for anyone that's not seen it, what you've got is you've got a picture of Macron sitting at a table with the new German Chancellor Merz sitting next to him, and Keir Starmer is coming into the room with the press. And there's a white bag, or what looks like a bag of white powder in the middle of the table, and a little kind of spoon-like object next to it. And Macron grabs the bag of white powder and just hides it with his hand, and Merz grabs the little spoon. Now, I've seen a photograph, and I'll share it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which is taken because these cameras nowadays are very good high resolution cameras, so it's from the original footage shot, and it is quite a detailed picture of it. It's definitely not a tissue. It looks like a bag with a yellowy white powder inside it, sort of screwed up at the end, that's been just left on the table as the press came in.
Well, I mean, the implication here is that Macron on his own, or possibly Macron with Merz, were having a little toot on the coke on their way to Kiev to meet with Zelensky, who is widely reputed to like the odd line himself. Now, it doesn't mean... I mean, obviously, it's got out there now on the internet. The French government have denied it all. But there it is. You know, you can make,
so the
make
BBC
of it what you
say will. It's a false claim that it could not be cocaine, but the BBC surely don't know that. This is part of the reason why there's this problem with fake news at the BBC, is because they can't possibly know that it's not cocaine, but they're saying it's all false claim.
Well, we can't know that it is either.
No, I know.
But the point is the suspicion is there, isn't it? I mean, Zelensky, when he came here some while ago, gave a press conference, and it was quite clear because he was sniffing and snorting all the way through the press conference. I don't know if you've ever done cocaine, Tony, but it affects your nostrils for up to a day afterwards, and you go all the time because your nose is running.
Well, you could call it nostrilitis.
Yes. It was, you know, if you watch the footage, it's pretty clear he probably has been snorting coke. You can imagine that
France has denied Russia's false claim of drug use by Macron, Merz and possibly Starmer.
Yes, well, obviously the Russians have picked up on this and said this is what's going on. I don't think Starmer is the type. You see, don't forget that Macron used to
don't
be...
Don't you?
No, not to snort cocaine. He's too boring. But Macron, on the other hand, don't forget he was a top banker. And, you know, it's well known that top bankers do indeed indulge in this kind of thing.
It looks like a bag of cocaine very much to me, and I will share it later on at thisweek.org.uk. But they're saying that this is Russian disinformation.
Well, I mean, the Russians are tongue-in-cheek saying, well, this is what it looks like. Because, of course, there's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that Zelensky is. I mean, there's another picture, have you seen it this week, of Zelensky giving, I think, Macron a cuddle. But he's clearly got his pants on back to front, because the zip where the fly is on his backside. And there is, you know, you know, off-colour jokes have been... This is the sort of gossip on the internet that you can't really stop.
Well, Maria Eagle is boasting about the RAF helping the genocide, earlier on Tuesday, the British government was in court facing a legal challenge over its decision to allow the export of F-35 parts to a global pool that could eventually end up on Israeli jets. So they've set up this global pool in order to try and cover the trail of whereabouts the bits that are helping with the genocide are coming with. They also had Hotavelli, who's the Israeli ambassador to Britain, at this event. She issued an official complaint to the BBC over a documentary aired on children in Gaza because the child's narrator was the son of a minister in Gaza. The film was ultimately pulled. Now, we covered that. In fact, we shared the film itself. But it seems to me, Martin, look, if you just cut to the chase here, that the Israelis are so arrogant, such control freaks, so hateful, that they think that they can just, by controlling, owning, using the press, the civil service, the government in this country, they can get away with genocide and killing more and more, and another 100 today, Palestinians. The idea is that they want to mow the lawn until there's no Palestinians left.
Well, it's not just mowing it, it's digging it up and killing it all off, isn't it? They're going to just concrete it over. It's horrific. I mean, you know, it's hard to be alive at this moment and see that it's quite possible that all of these people in Palestine are going to be starved to death in front of us. And our government is absolutely complicit. And ultimately, there's going to have to be some war crimes trials, or the law is going to have to be enforced one way or another on the people behind all of this. They really need to think. The legal advice that the British government was given when we still had the Tories in power was that there is definitely the possibility that British people, if complicit in this, could end up in the International Criminal Court. And that is for sure. They are definitely guilty. In my mind.
Just news today, the US will not force Israel to end the Gaza slaughter. And also Trump wants to take Gaza and turn it into a freedom zone still. This is what he's been saying.
Freedom from people, yeah. All the Palestinians gone, and it's free to develop for the billionaires to have a nice golf course on. Wonderful.
He's also sent a nuclear proposal to Tehran. This is a bit of a sticky subject, Iran, isn't it? He demands that Iran acts quickly. The president threatened that something bad would happen to the Islamic Republic if Tehran did not rapidly come to an agreement with the United States. Now, this is sort of threat is not really worthy of any real statesman, is it? Unless you do as I say, something bad's going to happen to you. This is the sort of thing you might expect a shopkeeper to get when they get a visit from the mafia.
Yes. But, of course, the Iranians, to their credit, are talking to them because they do not, you know, it makes sense to talk to them, even if you're not going to agree with them. Pretty much what the Russians are doing with the Trump administration. We will talk to you because we don't want to be seen to be unreasonable, but don't try and bully us because we're not going to be bullied. The same with the Chinese. We'll talk to you, but don't try and bully us because we're not going to have it.
So they're trying to do a deal with the Iranians. I think the idea seems to me to be as soon as you start talking to the Americans, then they find some reason why you haven't done what they said, and then they start a war with you.
Well, the Houthis have obviously done a deal with the administration where they stop shooting at their aircraft carriers and ships, provided they're allowed to carry on attacking Israel, which they have done. And but they also made a statement, and Nasrallah made a statement saying to other Arab states and Iran, don't trust the Americans. They're not trustworthy. And you know, you can't really do deals with people who don't stick to deals. This is the problem. They're not deal worthy. They say one thing and then they just, as soon as it suits them, they rip it up. Now, at that point, there's not much point trying to do a deal with them, is there?
A couple of weeks ago, Haaretz came up with what I thought was an excellent, which I'll share on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Agent of Chaos, it says, how Netanyahu thrives off havoc. Prime Minister Netanyahu announced his decision to appoint Eli Shavit, former head of the Israeli Navy, as the next head of the Shin Bet Security Service. the head of the Israeli Navy, of course, is in charge of their German-supplied Dolphin submarines, which have nuclear ballistic missiles on them. So he's a very trusted guy by Netanyahu, who is in part of their very important part of their nuclear-armed doomsday cult. So his decision comes despite petitions submitted to the High Court of Justice challenging the dismissal of the current Shin Bet director, Ronan Barr, who will be heard. So he's going to be booted out. But anyway, Netanyahu, in fact, he has restarted the chaos machine for which he is known. After all, this isn't a functional appointment. It certainly wasn't made out of professional considerations or in good faith. It's a political manoeuvre that puts all the players into an impossible situation. That's how Netanyahu operates. With a single announcement, he's managed both to needle the institutions and individuals he's clashing with, the Supreme Court, the Attorney General, and the outgoing Shin Bet director, whilst also setting a trap for the opposition and the protest movement. What they're saying here is, is this effectively a dictatorship now?
Well, I would not go. It's an oligarchy with a chief oligarch. Let's put it that way. There is a democracy in Israel for some Israelis, but it's not really a democracy of any kind for the Palestinians who are being genocided. They don't get a vote in any of it, do they?
Netanyahu thriving off havoc, would you agree?
Yes. I mean, Haaretz is a kind of equivalent of the Guardian here, so they're quite critical of... I mean, you know, in many ways, in fact, Haaretz has been more critical of the Israeli government than the Guardian has been here, because, they're more combative. But at the same time, it's very hard to see how any reasonable, responsible Palestinian can do any kind of deal with a regime that's as brutal as this one. You know, loads of people have to go to prison before you can even start talking to them, wouldn't they?
So another piece of news this week about Gaza, 400 actors at the Cannes Film Festival and film directors have condemned the Israeli genocide. Little reporting of that, but here is this report from Iran's Press TV.
We are joined by Mr. Bruno Biclini, academic and political analyst from Porto Alegre, Brazil. Mr. Biclini, nice to see you again. Mr. Biclini, your thoughts on the significance of this move by nearly 400 cinema professionals condemning the ongoing Israeli genocide, and how can it help the plight or with the plight of the Palestinians?
Well, thanks for having me. I can compare this position of the filmmakers, directors, actors, actresses, producers in Cannes Festival when Jane Fonda has gone to Hanoi during the Vietnam War and took pictures beside the cannons and the anti-air artillery from the Vietnam government. That's the situation. We can compare the majority of the Hollywood and the filmmakers community against the State Department, against the Netanyahu war cabinet, and considering what is happening now in Gaza and Palestine as a online genocide, I could say so. I don't know how far can it go, because for example, Trump considered Hollywood an enemy, an inside enemy, like in the McCarthyism days. But for the Western societies, the Western civil society, this is a goal for Palestine for sure.
Yeah, so how far can it go? He's made a brilliant point there, I think, which is Trump considers Hollywood can be a hostile enemy within America.
Well, yeah, then the Cannes is not really Hollywood, is it? It's more art cinema than Hollywood cinema. Well, I mean, it's great that people who are involved in the arts like that are speaking up. But, of course, it's compared to the enormity of what's going on, it's hard, you know, they should be speaking up, but it's not going to stop it, is it?
Well, I think, in a way, the raising of consciousness, a bit like Adil Raja was saying last week, things are really, this is changing the whole world. We had that MP speaking, well, not necessarily the whole world, because there's still a few Zionist maniac genocidalists out there, but people are finding it much more difficult to sit on the fence, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is actually a potentially world war starting event. I mean, you know, when Gavriil Princip assassinated Archduke Ferdinand, that was pretty obscure to most people, but it led to World War I. But the murder of 2.5 million people on social media while everybody's watching, I would say that's a pretty good casus belli for World War III, isn't it? We shouldn't be tolerating this. The UN Charter and all the suffering, the sacrifices, so that you can go and do that again. Is that really what we're going to stand for?
Well, no, it isn't. No. Can you see Trump's mission to Saudi Arabia? I mean, I think the idea is that they're trying to put it across as, and Adil was saying last week, this is optics, as a way of, well, he's going to Saudi Arabia and he's kind of sidelining the Israelis.
Well, Trump is unpredictable. That's the predictable thing about him, is that he's unpredictable. Even the people who work with him probably don't know what he's going to say next. And therefore he's putting, you know, he doesn't want Netanyahu to get the feeling that he can just do what he wants. So he's then gone to the Saudis, who are quite pro-Israeli anyway, let's face it. They've been put in a position because, being the leading wealthy Arab power, they're not democratic in any way, shape or form, obviously. He's hoping that he can just do loads of deals and the Palestinians will accept that they can't have a state, but, you know, will probably give him some jobs as waiters maybe or cleaners in the new Gaza. It's the way his mind works, but it's way, way out of line with the realities of the situation, isn't it?
Also, Palantir, I'm sure you're familiar with. Certainly Matt O'Brannan was last week. He was giving us loads of even information we hadn't heard before about Palantir. This, the boss, Alex Karp, he was doing some sort of presentation where someone stood up and had a go at him, quite rightly too. Anyway, his answers are quite interesting because it's a little bit more difficult to hear the lady that stood up in the audience and started complaining about the use of his technology to AI to murder loads of Palestinians and daddy's home and this sort of thing. But here we can hear Alex Karp, Bilderberger. Of course, that time is coming close, folks, in a month's time, over in Oslo, Stockholm. That's where we're going to have Bilderberg. And we'll have hope to have some reports that week from there. But this is when what she had to say when she stood up. And listen very carefully to Alex Karp, the Bilderberger, the boss of Palantir, what he's got to say.
That a few people get wealthy, and if you said platitudes that were obviously stupid, you could... Oh.
You're killing my family in Palestine.
Yeah. And,
what kind of person are you? How do you sleep at night?
Well, if you, do you want to hear my answer?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. So, I think the primary cause of death to Palestinians.
That's not funny.
Okay. Do you want to hear the answer, or do you want to yell?
For no reason.
Well, you don't want to hear an answer.
I want to hear
obviously. So the primary source of death in Palestine is the fact that Hamas has realized that there are millions and millions of useful idiots that will...
Using that excuse, this is why you don't get a platform to speak. Because you are killing my people and you're justifying it because of Hamas or anyone else.
Can we get security up there?
Okay. Your AI and your technology from Palantir kill Palestinians!
Mostly terrorists, that's true.
No!
I believe, she believes I'm evil. I believe she's an unwitting product of an evil force, Hamas. That she unwittingly is part of their strategy, that she is a product. And the most important thing, arguably, in the book or what Palantir or what you could learn is, do not become a product of an ideology that sounds sensible.
Well, I mean, it's just defending the indefensible again, isn't it? Palantir is a for-profit company, and they've engaged in making money out of supplying weaponry to the Israeli government, which is killing innocent people. And, of course, there's money to be made there. And, of course, it's Hamas's fault because they got elected in 2006. Did Alex get elected by anybody? Did MBS in Saudi Arabia, who voted for him? Yahya Sinwar represented, who is dead now, represented his people. And but we can't talk to them because they're evil, you see. Unlike Likud, who are the ones who bombed the King David Hotel in the 1940s and killed 1,000 people, they're not evil, they're good. So
I don't think King David killed 1,000 people.
It's a lot.
It was quite a few, but I don't think it's 1,000
well,
people.
Well, all right, but I mean, the point is that the creation of the State of Israel was steeped in blood. Steeped in blood.
Anyway, he says she's a product of Hamas's propaganda machine.
Well, that's what he would say, wouldn't he? Most people outside Palestine aren't part of Hamas. Of course, they're not. But Hamas are the elected government of their country. Now, I'm not necessarily in favour of Hamas, but I'm in favour of the principle that the elected government of a country should be treated with respect. Maybe we shouldn't be talking to the Israelis at all. They're out of the, you know, they're out. They're out, maybe Likud and all of the right wing in Israel, maybe they are evil. And because they're evil, we shouldn't be talking to them. And of course, Palantir are, in fact, speaking on behalf of those evil people. Terrorists, as they were, killing British Army soldiers and police officers and random civilians. That's how they created their state. Hamas is copying them.
So, anyway, Jeffrey Sachs we have on here quite a lot. He's saying this week he thinks that the United Nations should form a world government of some sort. Let's have a listen to that.
And there's one other concept that I find very, very useful. And it's actually embodied in the European idea. It came from the Catholic Church originally, but it's called subsidiarity. And the idea of subsidiarity is, let's get real. We need governments at all levels. We need a global government, that's the UN. We need a regional government, that's the European Union. We need a national government, that is the government of Cyprus. We need a local government, that is the Nicosia City Hall where we are right now. You have governments at all levels.
So, yes, Jeffrey Sachs saying, actually, the United Nations, why don't we just make it into a world government? Well, there's all sorts of potential problems with that. It's obviously, we'd like to see a beefed-up United Nations where UN Secretary-Generals can get involved, as Dag Hammarskjöld did in Africa, without getting assassinated by the British and the Americans and the mining interests. So that was what the UN has originally envisaged to do, as a sort of fire brigade manager of difficult problems around the world, so that they could say, well, hang on, this is going from bad to worse here, let's intervene. The sort of thing like is going on in Gaza, for example. But he's what Jeffrey Sachs is saying, actually, world government is what a United Nations should be. That,
well, it's pie in the sky. I mean, even if you wanted a world government, and of course lots of people are very suspicious of the idea of a world government, it's not going to happen because the interests of different countries are too diverse. I mean, we're actually on the brink of a world war between the Shanghai Cooperation Organization countries and the NATO-dominated countries. So the idea that the UN would somehow, they'd have to be based on Mars and be run by the Martians, wouldn't they? And then they could intervene and try and stop us fighting each other. Ultimately, we do have to have coordination across this tiny little planet of ours so that we all share the resources. But that doesn't necessarily mean a top-down international government, does it?
No. And one of the reasons we've got all these trouble in the world, the UN would like to sort out, but for some reason can't, because of the threats involved, is something called the SAS and the SBS. And Panorama this week, on Monday, between 8 and 9 o'clock, had a special programme, Martin, talking about I saw war crimes, I was there, to do with Afghanistan and Iraq, with the SAS explaining that they were being coached by their senior officers how to write a report to make sure it was not going to be investigated, even though they were committing war crimes by executing people who'd done nothing wrong.
Yes, I mean, what's significant about the Panorama program? We're talking about the BBC doing things. Well, this is them taking a fairly strong line here. And, of course, they've actually interviewed ex-SAS and SBS personnel, and they're saying, yeah, that was out of control, and, you know, there's something will have to be... I think, in actual fact, the British, Australian and New Zealand SAS and SBS are going to have to be disbanded as a result of all of this. They've just blotted the copybook so badly. Don't forget...
But they're an indispensable tool of the elite, because the point is that you can send in the special forces and you don't have to go through Parliament. You don't have to go through the official Ministry of Defence channels. They are just literally... they're off the books, basically.
Well, I mean, there's plenty of... If you know
probably
anything,
in Ukraine right now.
Yes.
Maybe, yeah, even parts of Russia, possibly.
Yes, and if you know anything about the SAS, you will know that they all go off into private military companies after they've done their time in the SAS. A guy from the SAS, or two guys from the SAS, went out to Colombia in the 1990s, assassinated a local environmental regulator who was about to put a fine on BP for making a mess, and then they came back and rejoined the SAS. It was just a two-week holiday for which they were presumably paid in cash. This is how these things work. But, of course, what's been going on in Afghanistan was that they were going out in the middle of the night and just killing random people. And they were getting into the whole thing of, we've got to kill. And, of course, what actually happens is the next morning, the regular army then go out to patrol that village. And they're the ones who get shot at and bombed because of what the SAS did the night before.
Isn't the idea of what the SAS were doing? We're going to hear a clip from this bit panorama in a minute. Isn't the idea to actually seed hatred and to fuel the expansion of a conflict?
Well, it could be. I mean, there's a book called Nemesis about what happened in Northern Ireland, which is where the SAS were going out and killing people at random in order to stir it all up. So the idea that they were a peacekeeping force, very questionable. But the point I would make before we hear the clip is if I was a senior officer in the British Army or the Australian Army or the New Zealand Army, you going around killing people like that, did you win the war? The answer is no. You lost the war by doing that.
I mean, most of the wars the British and the Americans get involved in nowadays, they don't seem to have any intention of winning, just creating havoc as much as possible. I think, was it Dan Glazebrook's book, Divide and Ruin? Anyway, let's have a listen now to some of these confessions from SAS. And it's brilliant the BBC have done this because, in a way, these guys have got no accountability by parliamentary means, and so the BBC is the only way they can speak out.
Not all killings in war are the same. Under both British and international law, troops shouldn't deliberately kill unarmed civilians or prisoners of war.
It's cut and dry. A non-combatant can never be intentionally harmed in war. The line between a soldier and a murderer. The difference is that the soldier, when the soldier has to take another human life, he or she will do so according to a warrior's code. They kill according to the laws of armed conflict, the laws of war. We have to hold our soldiers to that standard.
Our witnesses say the SAS had already developed a method of covering up unlawful killings in Iraq. They planted weapons, known as drop weapons, on the bodies of those they'd killed to make it look as if they were armed, and then took photos to justify the killings.
Iraq was awash with drop weapons. You'd see it a lot. Too many reports of a gun being found by someone's left hand, things like that. I mean, it's a classic mistake if someone's planting a weapon. You knew it didn't stack up. It was widespread. We all knew what was happening.
We've been told what the SAS did in Iraq, they did in Afghanistan. The eyewitnesses say they saw drop weapons being routinely used to cover up unlawful killings.
Absolutely, drop weapons were being used. There was a load of weapons that the guys had handed over to our guys by the previous squadron who'd been on deployment just before us. Some AKs and things like that, that you could plant on a body. It took a little while for the officers to work out exactly what the squadron was up to on operations. But pretty soon they could be in no doubt.
You'd see a lot more folding stock AKs. Because of the way they're designed to fold, they were easier to carry in day sacks. Easier to bring onto the targets and plant by the body. To make it look like the person was holding a rifle when they were shot. We'd had grenades that didn't detonate. They wouldn't go off.
The public inquiry has only been looking at allegations about the SAS. We've been told the Navy's special forces also committed war crimes in Afghanistan and used drop weapons to cover them up. Of the sources we've spoken to, more than 10 served with or alongside the Special Boat Service, or SBS.
How did I know they were planted grenades? I saw the same ones in the SSE photos. The photos coming back from the ops, I was like, hang on, I've seen that before.
One eyewitness says wounded Taliban fighters were routinely killed.
On one operation, a guy had been shot, but he was still breathing. You know, shallow breaths. The medic was standing over him, treating his injury. He'd been shot a couple of times, but it wasn't life-threatening. Then one of our blokes came up to him, and there was a bang. He'd been shot in the head at point-blank range. And then the body was just lying there. Everyone found on target was killed on target, pretty much. I can't recall us taking a single injured insurgent back to base for treatment. They were shot there and then. It's completely unnecessary. There's a right and a wrong way to act. These are not mercy killings. It's murder.
So that's the BBC's Panorama on Monday. Martin, I'll put a link to the full thing up on our show page and the BBC version 2 at thisweek.org.uk later. Psychologically, it's interesting, though, isn't it? I mean, you would think potentially this is something that the soldiers, as well as the Ministry of Defence, would want to cover up. They wouldn't really want the BBC making a programme about this.
No, but you can see the guys that they've interviewed are genuinely upset about what's happened.
So they've seen their colleagues doing this?
Yes. I mean, you know, not everybody is a monster. Some people, when they see things like that, say that, you know, their conscience says, no, that's wrong. Can I also point out, leaving aside the rights and wrongs of the morality of it, what did you think it did to the Taliban insurgency in Helmand province if the SAS go around just killing people at random and everybody in the province will know? You're not going to fool their families. Yeah. They've got very big families, and you kill some 16-year-old boy out of hand. He's got 30 cousins who, under Pashtunwali, which is the
this is what I was saying earlier.
They have to go and kill British soldiers.
Well, this is what I was saying earlier, in that this is a deliberate tactic in order to spread the violence, to actually seed a much wider armed conflict.
Well, in some circumstances, I might agree with you. I mentioned the book Nemesis about Northern Ireland earlier. In this context, I think not. Because at one stage, the Australian SAS, when they got their first kill, they go back to the base. This guy had his leg blown off during the Soviet occupation. So they got hold of his leg. They killed him. They got hold of his leg. It was an artificial leg. And when you killed your first Afghan, yeah, or Untermensch, whatever you want to call them, you had to drink a whole yard of ale from this leg, which was in the base. Now, the internal culture of these highly skilled units can become toxic and poisonous. Yeah. So if of course, one of the things you'd be doing, if you're one of the guys who's doing this, any new person, you're going to make sure they get dirtied up so that they also kill people. So nobody's going to say anything, because if anybody says anything, we're all going down. And of course, this is actually, I'm not just going on about the morality of this now. If I was a British Army commander, I would be saying, this is what's losing us the war. If we want to win in Helmland Province, we've got to convince the locals that we're doing the right thing. And that's not the way to do it, is it?
Did they ever want to win, really?
I think
they were they just there for
the reason why the British Army
to disrupt and destroy the country like they've done to Libya.
No, the reason they what happened with Helmland, don't forget, a lot of what goes on in warfare, Tony, isn't necessarily
to do with opium too.
Yes, of course. Yes, I mean, I was talking to a guy within the Coldstream Guards. And I said, and he was in Afghanistan. And he said, well, why did you join the Coldstream Guards? I said, I was addicted to heroin in Britain, and one of my cousins was in it. And he said, well, why don't you join? That'll get you out of heroin. So I did. I joined the Coldstream Guards. I went to Afghanistan, and I found myself marching around fields full of poppies, which, of course, you know, during our British-American occupation of Afghanistan, there was a massive increase in heroin production.
Yeah, the Taliban had stopped it.
Well, that's right. And, of course, Walid Karzai, who was the brother of Hamid Karzai, who was the president, he was heavily involved in it, as were the CIA. Yeah. Mm. So, in other words, don't forget we were talking earlier about
Vietnam was a lot to do with the French, Americans taking over from the French.
There's a book, Alfred McCoy, you know, the CIA and drugs. The Western criminal system, Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo, is a major drugs distribution point into Europe, yeah, run by Albanian mafia people in cahoots with, I mean, if you're going to smuggle drugs,
with who?
With the CIA and the Western MI6, intelligence services. That's where MEK are based, who are a sort of terrorist group trying to overthrow the government of Iran. Basically, once you get out there and find out what's going on, a lot of it is just criminalized stuff, yeah? We're making money out of the occupation. It's going to the pockets of certain
people. You remind me a bit
of, and that's what we're doing.
What Adil was saying last week about the Baluchistan Liberation Army, and it's like one minute they're being funded by the Americans, and then the next minute the Chinese come along with a better offer.
Well, I mean, that they haven't come along with a better offer at the moment, but I mean, they're trying. The point is, it's actually a much murkier world out there than people think. You know, we didn't go to Afghanistan to make sure that women, girls could go to school.
The women didn't have to wear hijabs or whatever.
The main purpose we went to Afghanistan was to mess up the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. Afghanistan is right.
Also to open up a bit of a flank on the eastern side of Russia.
Indeed.
But
where it is.
Let's zoom down in on Northern Ireland now, somewhere you know quite well, Martin, because you did actually spend a bit of time over there during the Troubles, didn't you?
Well, I don't really want to talk. I went there once, Tony, to Belfast. But otherwise, I've just been into the Republic. I know a lot about it. Let's put it that way.
So what do you think was really going on over there?
Well, I mean,
Okay, let me just. I'll try and summarise it for you.
Yeah, go on.
In 1972, Lord Carrington, who was the Tory Defence Secretary, authorised authorised the army to shoot into a crowd of unarmed demonstrators. And that was what they called Bloody Sunday in 1972. Up until 1997 or 98, when they signed the Good Friday Agreement, effectively it was a training ground for sectarian, quasi-religious or pseudo-religious violence, which was a brilliant training ground for the British Army. And in fact, many Irish point to Palestine as a kind of equivalent conflict.
Yes, and of course, many Irish people today identify with the Palestinians because of the history of Ireland.
So, reasons? Who's this guy Steak Knife?
Well,
there's a whole program about
Anthony Scapitacci is his name. He's an Italian immigrant. His family were Italian immigrants to Northern Ireland, and he became a very trusted part of the IRA, but it turns out he was being run by Brigadier Gordon Kerr's Force Research Unit, as Brian Nelson was, who was the Chief Intelligence Officer of the UDA. And, of course, Brigadier Gordon Kerr's still out there drawing a pension at our expense, even though he was running both the IRA and the UDA.
The Loyalist terrorists and the Republican terrorists.
That's right, all being manipulated by the British Army.
By the British Army. I wonder, when you look at Palestine, there's a sort of equivalence in a way between the funding for Hamas coming via Qatar from Israel and the IDF fighting away there. So let's have a listen now to this BBC. And we've been moaning about the BBC earlier, but well, we love them really because they do programmes like this about Steak Knife.
Okay, we are in Anderson's Town, West Belfast, where I live, and we're just about to do an interview.
What's your name?
My name is Danny Morrison.
How do you feel about talking about this stuff?
Well, I'm fine. It's about an incident in my life in relation to Freddie Scapatici, which resulted in me being sentenced to 8 years in jail. It's also, of course, when you go into the background of it, it's quite revealing about the nature of the dirty war, about the immorality of the British government, which had even though I despise informers, had a duty towards these people whom it had recruited as agents or informers. And in the case of Freddie Scapatici, he was given clearance to kill people who were no longer of any use to the Ministry of Defence.
The starting point of the conversation with Danny Marson are the events of January 7th, 1990. Sandy Lynch, as we know, is taken to the house on Carrigart Avenue on the Friday night. Danny Marson isn't at the house yet. Freddie Scapatici is.
Unfortunately for Sandy Lynch, when the Scap's interrogating him, Scap's a British agent interrogating another British agent, Sandy Lynch breaks and admits to a number of offences.
According to Danny Marson, the reason he's going to the house is to assess Sandy Lynch. Marson is the Sinn Féin director of publicity, and the idea is that they're going to hold a press conference about Sandy Lynch, where the informer will talk to the media about his activities and how he was recruited by British intelligence.
I was concerned about the circumstances of the house that I was going to at this stage, because although I had been told that the IRA had left the scene and that Lynch agreed to do this press conference, as a director of publicity, and I had introduced informers to press conferences before, I wanted to ensure that the person who I was meeting, whom I had never met before, whom I still haven't met, I was concerned that he could turn out to be a Walter Mitty. And there was no way was I going to put him on a press conference if he turned out to be a Walter Mitty.
Sorry, Dan, you said you were told that the IRA had left the scene.
Yes.
How is that possible?
This is what I was told, that the IRA had left the scene and that to go to the house and that Lynch would be there with other Republicans, some of whom I also knew. So, for example, Gerard Hodgkins, who was in the house, had been a press officer for me in the Republican Press Centre.
He was a member of the IRA.
I'm not sure if he was ever sentenced for IRA membership. I know he was charged. He was an ex-prisoner, but he had been on the blanket.
But he would tell you himself that he was a member of the IRA.
Well, I'm not saying he was a member of the IRA. The other person...
He told me he was a member of the IRA, you know.
So what's happening there? I mean, I didn't listen to the programme. So Danny Morrison...
It's a long programme. It's a long series of programmes, actually. And I think it's a 10-part series. Each one is either half an hour or so. But it really does take you through the whole... I mean, it's really a lot of people long after the Troubles. So we're talking about 30 years roughly after things started settling down. These people now feel much more happy and content to talk about what went on. That particular guy, you said he's got some sort of connection with Republican News, was it?
Danny Morrison was the director. He was the director of Sinn Féin's publicity wing, and he was the editor of Republican News at one side. And he also... He went to the Sinn Féin Ardèche. He famously said, we're going to take power in Ireland with a ballot box in one hand and the Armalite in the other. And, of course, that got him into a lot of trouble because it was like, you know, it was, being pro-mass or whatever.
What he's discussing there is the interface between the IRA and the media, which was obviously very sensitive. And he's saying, I'm walking into a situation where this guy who's about to hold a press conference that I'm supposed to be chairing or in charge of, I've never even met him before and I don't know who he is. So there was a tremendous amount of distrust and secrecy.
Well, yes, it's, you know, when there's all this skullduggery going on, there's bound to be a bit of a distrust and secrecy. But I mean, what I get from that, and I don't know if we're going to hear another clip, is that he was going there to get to talk to him because he'd agreed. Because what the IRA used to say, if you are working for the British intelligence services or the police or whatever, if you come and tell us about it, we will not harm you. Yeah, don't be frightened. We know that they do this. I mean, the way they were able to get Donaldson, who's now who's dead now, was because he was actually having sex with the wife of a senior IRA guy, and the British were able to blackmail him. You wouldn't want Seamus to find out what's happening with his wife, would you? And, of course, he didn't want that to happen, so he started passing information to the British. Now, what the IRA internal operation used to say is, if that's what's happening, come forward, tell us what's happened, and we won't harm you. So this guy, Sandy, whatever his name was, he's going to be in
Lynch.
Yeah. Lynch. So he's going to talk to him and say, right, well, we'll give a press conference where you can talk about how the British recruited you and all the rest of it. And that's how we'll deal with it. But presumably, when he got there, Scapitacci had already slotted him, which means that he can't talk. And, of course, that means that the British intelligence operation is thereby protected by Scapitacci, who is, in fact, working for the British.
Although the IRA think he's working for them. Blimey, smoke and mirrors. So thanks for helping untangle that. But anyway, that is a long clip. It's a short clip from a long series, and I'll put the whole lot up, if you're into that sort of thing, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's probably something like 3-4 hours long, maybe. But it does take you through some of the most fascinating, it turns, and Northern Ireland. Of course, it's the BBC once more doing it. Well done, BBC. I feel like I'm being a bit schizophrenic about it all tonight. But we're going to finish this evening with a hearing from, we'll probably have Vernon Coleman next week, his new book, The End of Medicine, it's called. This week, we'll finish with David Livingston. He's talking here to me about his new book, which is Muslims versus Islam, Divide and Conquer. He comes out with a book about every year or so these days, and the last one was just about something about the heresy, Zionism, the great heresy or something. But anyway, this one is where he talks about the centuries of twisting Judaism and Islam for the geopolitical aims, largely of the, do you think that's right, Martin? The British have been very much involved in the twisting of Judaism into Zionism, and Islam into the things like Salafism.
Yes, because of course the British wanted to have an Israel. It was British Christian Zionists who wanted to have a state of Israel. Most Jews weren't interested in it. It was very, very minority. You know, why would we want to go there? But the British wanted to have a state there, so they definitely twisted Zionism, Judaism into Zionism. And of course, they also supported Salafi terrorism. In the 1980s, we supplied all the weaponry to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is still our allies now in Syria. The guy in charge in Syria is coming to Britain next week. He's Al-Qaeda ISIS. $10,000 used to be on his head, but they haven't had any elections in Syria, but he's the president now, and he's coming to meet Sir Keir Starmer next week. And guess what? He wants peace with Israel.
So who's he working for?
He's working for the British intelligence services, just as Al-Qaeda always has been.
Fascinating. Anyway, look, we'll have a listen now to a little while. We'll say goodbye to you, Martin, but we will have a couple of final clips from this interview I did yesterday with David Livingston, Centuries of Twisting Judaism and Islam for Geopolitical Purposes.
Zionism is born out of heresy of Judaism. So that's why I'm saying that until the late 1700s, in Europe, at least, Orthodox Judaism was a fairly homogenous tradition, or what's the word? Unified tradition. And you get a person, basically Moses Mendelssohn came along, who was friends with various members of the Illuminati. And according to Rabbi Marvin Antelman, Moses Mendelssohn was regarded as a successor of Shabbatai Zvi. And he's the one who basically opened the way for the creation of Reform Judaism. So this is why you have this new Judaism which dares to go against traditional Judaism. So, and the fact that they are Sabbateans, what's the main teaching of Shabbatai Zvi was that with the arrival of the Messiah, which he claimed to be, the rules of the Torah no longer applied. So they threw out the Talmud in favor of the Zohar. So the Zohar is what they follow. They reject the laws of the Bible, but they hold to the same prophecies. So that's why what you see is the creation of is an intent to colonize Palestine towards the creation, towards fulfilling Bible prophecy without following any of the rules of the Bible. And on the contrary, you see actions which are, I would say, overtly Luciferian in terms of their, you know, open malice. Because it's exemplary of their rejection of the Jewish legal, you know, Jewish morality.
Yeah, you've given us a bit of context there as to, particularly on the Jewish side. What about the Islamic side? I mean, we know from what you were saying earlier on that, you know, there are some problems with Islamic eschatology, the way that they, Muslims, see this sort of thing. Is there anything that you can say to elucidate it for us? What is the correct way to read this, for, as far as you're concerned, from the Muslim scriptures?
Yeah, so it's a little complicated. So the problem is that, you know, ever since, so, you know, the Zionists collaborated with the Arabs of Arabia to organize the Arab revolt to help overthrow the Ottoman Empire. So the Ottoman Empire was a traditional Islamic civilization which had existed since the 1400s, even earlier than that, but it was the conquest of Constantinople in 1453. And then the Zionists arrange for the cut up of the Islamic world into several puppet states. So that's where you get places like Jordan, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and so on and so forth, and most importantly, Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia was handed over to a long-standing British agent. It's a family, the Saud family, which had already very close relationships with the British for decades before, perhaps even further back. And that's why Saudi Arabia has been serving ever since as the main tool of colonization in the Muslim world. So most of the funding for the various, in fact, the movement to spread the Salafi or Wahhabi version of Islam taught in Saudi Arabia has been measured to be the largest propaganda campaign in history, larger than even the Soviet Union. Zionists using the Saudi state have been spreading this deviated version of Islam, and so it's been estimated in the United States they control as many as 80% of the mosques. So Muslims are basically in the dark these days. They don't realize to what extent they are being manipulated, and to what extent they've been estranged from classical Islam, and you know, to what extent they've inculcated these sort of bizarre, diluted, literalist interpretations of Islam funded by Saudi Arabia. So what that's done is that it's produced a number of groups. So like I said, the most important one is Salafism, and the other one is Muslim Brotherhood. And that's been one of the most important organizations. So out of that, you get most of the political and terrorist organizations of the 20th century. So that's where you get people like Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat was a nephew of Mufti al-Husseini, who's known as Hitler's Mufti, who worked very closely with the Nazis and the Muslim Brotherhood. And then most importantly, it was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood who founded Hamas. And this is classic. This is what's been happening throughout the century. It's constantly been the CIA has consistently exploited the Muslim Brotherhood in various places around the world to carry out their colonial objectives. The most famous one, of course, is in Afghanistan, where they worked to undermine the power of the Soviet Union. And then again, the creation of Hamas. So I think it's a well-known fact. I hope it is. That Hamas was funded by Netanyahu. Netanyahu wanted to undermine the influence of the PLO. So going through Qatar, he funneled billions of dollars to Hamas. And that's their purpose is there to provide Israel with the pretext by committing these ludicrous acts of violence, like this airstrike that they did, which basically opens the way for Israel to commit genocide and have a cover story for it.
So that's David Livingstone speaking to me yesterday about his new book, but also obviously about the all background to what's going on. The idea that here really the Saudi Arabians have got nothing whatsoever to do with the Arabs. They're just put there by the British many years ago, as were the Israelis. So is there really any difference between one and the other? But I also asked him about what to do about all this. What can we do?
Zionism is basically a Gnostic form of Judaism. So it's fundamentally Luciferian, which is why it doesn't... not only does it not abide by any sort of humanitarian sympathies, but it rejects them. And it adopts... inhumane approaches as necessary for fulfillment of their bastardized version of fulfilling Bible prophecy. And so we live in a century where it's been very important because the Zionists first managed to, as I said, working hand in glove with the various reform movements in the Islamic world to overthrow the Ottoman Empire, which liberated Palestine from Ottoman control, which allowed them to create the Zionist state. And then since then have been progressively increasing their power. First of all, created the United Nations, because the United Nations is to be the seat of the global government, which is what they believe is foretold, which is to have a seat in Jerusalem. Of course, you can see that they've been using Western powers, particularly the United States, to carry out their objectives by proxy. They've got puppet states installed across the Islamic world. And what we were seeing was, I think, to some extent, an attempt to accommodate public opinion and to try to disguise their actions, to not invite excessive criticism. But I think what we're seeing now is an assurance, a level of confidence that they have arrived at a point where they no longer need to care. And I think that's the danger. And I think we're seeing that, especially in the Islamic world, with all the states basically just watching the debacle that's happening in Gaza without the slightest degree of criticism. And, beyond that, establishing or normalizing ties with Israel, as they refer to it. It shows that, the fact that this can happen under the world's eyes without really any kind of organized international condemnation, no sanctions, it shows you to the extent of how much the efforts over the last century has kind of power they've managed to secure over the last century. And so for me, the danger is that they feel confident enough to proceed without bothering with what the rest of you and I think. So it means that, what's in front of us is now more clear than ever. I think, it probably was this powerful for a long time, but we were in denial. But now we're finally seeing what we're up against. And combating it is not going to be easy, and we have to recognize that. But this is what the golf comes down to, right? This everything that's happening is a test from God, and it is the test from God. And we people look to each other and to look at what's in their bank account, what kind of a political power they have, to size what kind of effect they can have, as opposed to people see the extent of Zionist influence in the world and they wonder what can they do. And that's exactly the point. The point is that they will never gain the power that God has. God is waiting for believers in humanity to recognize that the power lies with Him, that the solution is they have to do their best effort, but the victory can only come when they plead for His help.
So that's David Livingstone. The victory can only come when they plead. That's us, folks, for God's help. So definitely prayer, very important. But to understand that the only really mighty power that can defeat evil right now is God. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Actually, it was Catherine Austin Fitz that first said that, I heard. Time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And also, of course, to sound engineer Dave Pazenko, also to Steve, who joined us earlier on. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews, story clips, etc. And before we go, I ought to read our little poem of the week. It's called Ode Out of Eton Mess He Came. It's cool. Out of Eton Mess he came, Eric Arthur Blair his name. Way back then he seemed a nerd, dystopia from victory, absurd. Fast forward, look around and see, a boot now stomped on faces be. War is peace, ignorance is strength. Double think, that makes no sense. The best books read tell us what we know, seizing power to not let go. Revolution acts now find, for truth-telling in deceitful times. Orwell wrote of all these crimes, long ago before they chimed, foretold a future full of grief. Words on page decried belief. Now past is present, present past, the stage is set and set to last. Just how and why he knew the truth, George a spy, perhaps a sleuth. George to MI5 no stranger, way back then, perhaps in danger. Saint or snitch, the jury's out. The 38 cheesed off, no doubt. Behind his work, dire warnings gave for plans ahead in years quite grave. A brave new world entwined and fold. Words are cheap until all sold. A warning then, each page, each line. George Orwell's nod, ahead of time. Thanks very much. Thanks very much, Patricia. If you don't mind, send me interviews and story tips on my Telegram channel and via Not the BCFM Politics Show page. Thanks ever so much. Really appreciate everybody that's able to send me a little monthly sub. Just a pound, even a fiver or something. Anything is really appreciated. Where you can also pick up the podcast, the full-length interviews, story links and the comment page. Subscribe to the free weekly newsletter. If you can afford it, as I say, donate or even set up a small monthly sub at this week, oneword.org.uk. You can do that either straight into the bank account or else via PayPal. I'm Shadow Banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Also banned until I think it's like 1 o'clock tomorrow morning on Facebook from posting anything on my Palestine pages, which I edit. That's a Bristol Palestine group. And also this show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. a week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. You get my good old book called The Siege of Heaven Reader, which is all about a secret government anthology. It's a little anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana Association. And get hold of that at www.bilderberg.org, as well as my Arnhem book. This is a stream on Bristol live at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. That's the talkradio.org.uk stream, I was trying to say then. And if you can restream us live or rebroadcast this show, please let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters we've been hearing so much about tonight get you down.
Morning bells will chime. We have a mission to make Britain a country that works, not for the privileged and not for the few, but for every one of our citizens. And together, we, the Conservative Party, can build a better Britain.
She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar. No, you can't trust her. No, 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 no. She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar. No, you can't trust her. No, 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 no. We all know politicians like telling lies. Big ones, little ones, porcupines. Saying they're strong and stable, won't disguise. We're still being taken for a ride. Nurses going hungry, schools in decline. I don't recognize this broken country of mine. They're having a laugh, they show them the door, then cut the rich, not the poor.
I've been very clear that I think we need that period of time, that stability, to be able to deal with the issues that the country is facing. I'm not going to be calling a snap election.
She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar. No, you can't trust her. No.
For my child, where she can grow and feel inspired. Do everything in your power you can. People rising up is the only plan. When future generations look back at this time, they will judge us not only by the decision that we made, but by what we made of that decision. They will see that we shaped them a brighter future. They will know that we built them a better Britain.
She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar.
I know.